You saw him defeat the Overlord, and you're the hunter from the future. Now watch him become... a father?
Come on, Daddy! Pay attention to your children.
But fatherhood just isn't what he expected.
I swear, that man never gives those kids any attention.
Preach it, girl.
It's like they're not even his kids.
That's because they're not.
Well, honey, you should have thought about that before you started taking extra wives. Polygamy rolls both ways, dear, and I'm cuter.
That's not true.
Honey, you spend your days in a loincloth fighting dinosaurs and letting Pag follow you around like a dog. I'm a dance instructor. Enough said.
A good dance instructor she is.
But he'll learn the real value of fatherhood when the new neighbors come to town.
Hey, neighbor, here's a gift.
It's a saw with glasses.
I know. I call it my seesaw.
Right.
And I'm going to destroy your whole entire world. One triplet at a time.
What was your name again?
They call me the Underlord. That's better.
Even a man like you're the greatest warrior ever to live in a bizarre future world where nothing makes any sense, will be tested.
Hey, kids!
Yeah?
Put this in your dad's soda. It'll be funny.
Okay.
Okay, Daddy.
Daddy, drink!
Drink!
Wait a minute.
Gotcha. That's just the beginning.
Even family will be driven to the brink.
Oh, Pag. He's been throwing up all week. I keep telling him not to drink dinosaur blood, but he just won't listen.
Know this well, I do. Cleaning up puke all day, I am. Getting tired, I am. Enough I have had. Put a cork in it, he should. Yes.
This summer, experience the joy of yore with the whole family. Starring Bela Lugosi.
Now that I have learned what you have learned, it is time for me to return to my people, away from this infernal place.
Megan Fox.
Your people are dead, Shia. I mean, your. So get your act together and be a father to these children.
Carrot Top.
Heh heh, check this out. I made a bumblebee that lives inside a tube of pot smoke. I call it a bumblebee. Heh heh, get it? You're not funny.
And featuring Yoda in his first feature-length film under the pseudonym Terrence McTasty.
Deadbeat Daddy is...
And a bunch of random robot fights that go on for entirely too long for no discernible reason other than to make the movie cost more money than it's worth. Directed by 9-time Academy Award winner Michael Bay. Wait, what? Right. Anyway, directed by Michael Bay and guest starring Tommy Wiseau.
Oh, hey, Mark.
You're too, the hunter who used to be from the future, but now spends his days realizing that destroying the island was a terrible mistake. He'll regret until the day he dies. Even an Aryan from the future can't escape responsibility in the form of a soul-sucking poop machine.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 211.
You're the hunter, or you're the hunter who brings death and destruction everywhere he goes.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Ju.
Oh. You did it out of order.
You should just let Paul go first because he's the one who does the tagline.
Okay, it'll go Paul, Julia, David. So yeah. I'll just say my name again. I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
I'm David.
And today's torture cinema. Yay. In any case, we are watching, or well, we watched, I do this every time where I talk about that we're watching it, but we're not actually watching it. We're watching a film called You're the Hunter from the Future, which was voted on by listeners, and then corruption got involved and money exchanged hands, and then this was picked. So
basically, Sean takes bribes, so the record is clear. There is a precedent. If you want us to watch a specific movie and you offer us enough money, that might happen.
It should be noted that the amount of money I will take is fairly low, because I also probably shouldn't take a lot of money, because then we're not eligible for a fan award anymore. And that would be sad.
And you took the money. It was all in a joke, just to reassure those Hugo nominators and listeners who might think that we're completely and utterly corrupt and trying to make money off this podcast. We'll just put their minds at ease.
That money went toward the WorldCon fundraiser. It's fine.
It's going to buy me a meal.
Yeah, it's going to buy you like one English breakfast.
No, I could get two, depending on where I go in London.
Well,
I know
you're
this,
assuming that it's going to be like less than £5.
I've gotten a full English breakfast for £3.50.
All right.
Granted, anyway.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to feed Sean at some point.
We're all going to have to feed Sean, but we shouldn't feed him after midnight.
Well played, Julia.
Or pour water on me. Yeah. Any case, all right. So, David, you are fresh for this. This is your first torture cinema.
Yay.
So I'm going to give you the honor. It is
his
first torture cinema with us. He has
never. Oh, really? You've never done this with us?
Nope.
Oh, welcome to the horror.
Yay, thank you.
This is the only thing that makes it worth it. We watch bad movies and then we talk about it for 2 hours. It's great. So I'm going to give you the honor of telling us what you're drinking first before other people talk about what they're drinking. So what are you drinking, sir?
I'm drinking a Diet Coke with lime. I'm your designated driver.
I'm just going to pretend that's a Diet Coke and rum with lime?
You don't understand the entire import of Coke.
No, I do. The problem, I just don't drink.
See, I'm always for this. We occasionally have people on who don't drink. And sometimes, like, when I haven't been feeling well, I haven't been drinking. And I'm always, like, of the opinion that we should not pressure anyone to drink.
You do not have to drink if you come on this show. That's true. As long as you do a Bela Lugosi impression, you're good.
I've, like, firsthand seen John Scalzi act completely drunk when I know he doesn't drink and the only thing he's had is Coke Zero.
He just gets drunk on Coke Zero.
Well, I'm just saying Coke products with no sugar can have that effect on people.
That's true, which is probably why he keeps drinking it.
Which is what David's drinking right now.
There we go. Yes. So watch out. Stand back.
All right. What about you, Julia?
I am drinking Shed Brewery Mountain Ale, a rugged brown ale.
Mm.
It's from Vermont.
Does Vermont make good ale?
That's pretty good. I like it.
I feel like you probably get better alcohol up there.
Honestly, if you buy stuff that's like independent breweries versus big companies, usually you're going to get pretty good quality.
Yeah, I'm not drinking good quality today.
What are you drinking, Sean?
I am drinking Publix brand, they're like not real sodas. They got zero calories, but they're like fruit flavored, like crystal sodas. They're like, they come in a long tube like bottle instead of like a regular soda bottle. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. It's got a mango orange, one of those, and then some Pinnacle whipped cream vodka.
Oh my god, you're having whipped cream vodka?
Yeah.
How is that? I've never had it before.
Surprisingly good. If you put it with something orange, like I imagine you could do it without soda, you could just do it like orange juice, but I feel like the soda makes it better. But
what if you put it with orange juice, if it's like vanilla flavored, that would be like a creamsicle.
It tastes with the whipped, it tastes like a creamsicle. That's what it tastes like. With orange, it is. It's tasty. So and it's vodka, which is my favorite of the alcohol families. Vodka. Pinnacle. It's a blue bottle. That's it. That's all I got. So what about you, Paul?
I am drinking a Summit Summer Ale. It's pretty light. It's not very malty. It's only moderately hoppy. It's a pretty good drink. I mean, Summit has grown larger over the years, so it's not quite that small anymore, but it's probably the premier
mid-sized brewery here in the upper Midwest, or certainly in Minnesota for that matter. It's good stuff.
Question about, because I don't drink beer. Oh my god, I just like burped in
we had this
mouth.
Conversation last time and concluded that you do like lambics, so you do drink beer sometimes.
A different question, because I know nothing about beers and ales. When a company becomes bigger, does like the quality just go to crap?
Not necessarily. It depends on what equipment they're using and what their brewing process is. So like Sam Adams is pretty good quality, and they're a pretty big company, but they do a lot of different specialty runs, and you can get stuff like sometimes the local stores in Boston will have very, very small batch stuff, which is usually going to be better because if you're doing it by small batches, usually you have more quality ingredients and greater control. But honestly, like I like a lot of the Sam Adams stuff, and that's a big company.
Oh, okay.
I think Sam Adams is the company that Summit's looking towards as their model for trying to expand and grow. And the beers are very similar. They have a suite of beers. They have some seasonal varieties. They do a lot of the same things Sam Adams does, but they're not quite as big by any standard. But
all right, sweet. In any case, so we've talked about what we're drinking, which is delicious and wonderful. I will be very drunk by the end of this. It's going to be great. But we should probably describe what this movie is about, since the listeners completely picked it on their own. There was corruption involved. But yes, so who would like to describe this movie? I feel like David should describe this movie, because
since this is his first torture cinema.
Yeah,
yes.
I think David should summarize this movie.
We should really break you in.
All right, so this is a film that began as a four-part television series in Italy and was put together as a feature film where we follow the extraordinarily blonde Yor, played by Reb Brown, as he goes through the apparently prehistoric landscape on a picaresque quest to find out what this mysterious medallion is that he has. And along the way, he encounters all kinds of different cultures, all of which are destroyed in his wake before the big reveal, which is given away in the title that this is not, in fact, the past, but the future, where he is in rather than being from.
Exactly.
That was an amazing description of this movie.
That's pretty
good.
You used
picaresque.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, he's competing with Mike for best use of vocabulary in torture cinema.
Right. Because what was it? What was the word that
apotheosis.
Mike used?
Apotheosis.
The apotheosis. Yes, it's right of disaster films. Is that his? Yeah. Yes.
I think of, like, sci-fi B-movies or something.
Ah, got it. Perfect. Yep. So now we have added picaresque to the Skiffy and Fanti vocabulary. So thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Yeah, keeping this particular feature high class, which is
doing
important.
My best.
Doing your best. Great. So anyway, so that's a pretty good description of it. We'll have many things to say. So why don't we just get into our likes and dislikes? And we'll start with you, Julia.
Are we liking first?
Let's do likes first, because I feel like our dislikes are going to be amusing.
Okay, so my first like is the theme song, because it's amazing.
Yes!
That was okay. One of mine.
And mine. This is the point at which I'm going to put the theme song right now.
I mean, I think you should have put a little snippet of it earlier and then play a longer snippet of it now.
I will have. What's great is we're currently from the future in which yeah. That has now happened.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. It is almost as amazing as the theme song itself.
But nothing is really that amazing, because, I mean...
But yes, okay, so this theme song, and I'm pretty sure the theme song was probably written in broken English, because there are some lines that don't make a whole lot of sense. They're just like, yeah, but it's a song called Yor's World, played by an Italian group. I think their last name is De Angelis. I've forgotten their first names. And the lyrics are just delicious, and I'm going to share them with everybody, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Unless you guys want to share the sharing with me.
Or Julia, did you have a favorite part of it?
I don't even know what the lyrics are, so now I'm like compelled to look them up and find out. So yeah, Sean, you should share them with us, and then maybe we can just all sing it.
Okay, I'm trying to get the lyrics right as we speak. Sorry.
On YouTube, there's a they play it with the lyrics, so you can sing along.
Yeah, I see that. So.
Oh my God, that is
so. They're saying "Yours World." He's the man. I knew the song was called "Yours World," but I kept hearing it as "Yours Slog," and I was like, "Is his name? Is his full name Yours Slog? How come they never actually call him Yours Slog anywhere?"
All right, I just put the lyrics in the thing. And it starts, "Yours world, he's the man. Yours world, he's the man. Yours world. Lost the world of past with the echo of ancient
blast."
I think that's blast. Blast is what it's actually. And then it goes, "Yours world. There's a man of future, a man of mystery. Yours world. No track to lead the way in his search for a yesterday. Yours
world.
Misty illusions hiding his famous destiny.
Yours world.
Yours, touch of fire. You're the crowd that we desire. He never seems to sleep. He's always on the run. Even his days are gone, they say he will go on. His search goes on and on.
Yours world.
He's the savior of babes."
Yours world. I think I saw different lyrics.
Oh my God. Is that in there? "And the world will set fire. He's going to make all the wild beasts look tame tonight in his tribe. Yours world, he's the man, he's the man. He's the savior of flames, and the world will set fire on the slow, deathless walk, and the world will set fire. Yours world."
Yours world.
Or, if you prefer, "Your slug."
Your slug.
Your slug, he's the man.
That's right.
Well, given the way his name is pronounced half the time in the film, I was wondering if it shouldn't be called Yar the Pirate from the Future.
This theme song is just hilarious. It is also a thing of beauty. And that's the thing, is like, we have watched two 80s movies that are terrible movies. Like, this one's, I think, better than Mannequin. But even with Mannequin, the best part of Mannequin was the theme song.
What did you say?
Say, I'm sorry? You just talked. What happened? Hello?
Hello.
Julia?
Can you guys not hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, so you turned into a robot for me for a while, and I didn't hear what you last said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know which part you got. I'll just repeat. This is the second 80s movie we have watched for Torture Cinema that is terrible but has a great theme song.
What's the other one?
Mannequin.
Mannequin.
What about Sons of Steel? Which is, I mean, awesome.
That's right. Sons of Steel also has great music.
The 80s. Bad movies.
Great theme songs. Yeah.
Great
theme
songs.
This one's,
I mean, like, even so, Highlander 2 did play a little bit of Queen.
When was Flash made?
1980.
Do you think they're mimicking, like, the Flash song, you know? I'm talking Flash Gordon, right?
Yes, yeah.
Flash,
They're mimicking so much in this movie, and we're going to get to this, and I'm like, just like, that's not funny. And it would not surprise me if they decided to mimic the theme song of Flash.
Okay.
Especially given the certainly the state of the Italian industry at that time. I think it was Luigi Cozzi who said the way it worked there is when you go to see a producer to do a pitch, the producer doesn't ask, "What is your film like?" The producer asks, "What film is your film like?" He says, that's why we'll always be making Zombie 2, never Zombie 1. So the derivative aspects, well, especially given the things like the helmets and stuff in here, so the music very likely is derivative in the same way.
I just love it. Yours world, he's the man.
With that synthesizer, yeah.
Yeah, it's
brought to you by Casio.
Exactly.
Awesome. That's great. Well, did anyone have anything else they said wanted to say about the theme song?
No, I think we're across the board agreed that it's a positive movie.
Awesome. All right, let's switch to our first dislike then. Julia, go.
All right, so this is actually serious, and that's that women did exist in this world, but they mostly existed as prizes for Yor. And like every single woman was a damsel in distress that Yor rescued, and then they wanted to like be his wife.
Point of order: there is one woman who did not want to be his wife, and Yor did not rescue.
That's true. That's one of my later likes. But most of the women that we see in this movie And I'm not counting little girls because there were little girls, but most of the women that we see are like women that Yor has to rescue, and they like cry out in damsel in distress ways, Yor, help! Like, you know, dinosaurs or cavemen or UFOs, something is attacking us, and then Yor comes and like saves them while they helpfully yell things like, Yor, watch out!
Yeah,
and then like after he's done doing that, they're like, okay, I will be your wife. And he's like, oh, I've got enough babes.
Yeah, it's incredibly, you know, they're from the school of don't just do something, stand there. They're incredibly passive, except for the obligatory catfight scene.
And that's like another part that I'm going to come up with in a later, item. But like, especially since the opening scene that we see is with Kala and Pag fighting a dinosaur, and I'm just gonna say that like at the opening it looks like she's a good hunter and she's into it, and then it turns out that like that's a fake out and she's not, and it's just all a setup to make her a damsel in distress, and we never actually see her doing any cool stuff like that.
Right, she never does again, even though she's clearly hunting with Pag.
Yeah, like the opening scene is her and Pag like actively hunting, and it seems like something she's good at and has done before, and then it turns out like no, and we never see her do it again.
She does get one more kick at the can when the Dimitrodon shows up, and she hits it in the head with her stone dagger. It's a blink and you'll miss it moment. But
I remember. Yeah. But it seemed like they could have just easily done, like, she and Pag could both be really good archers and have been done.
Yeah, they could totally have done that, but they did not.
Because that would have made her, I think, more interesting as a character.
They could have made her a little more like Katniss Everdeen, but they did not.
Or let her keep that man catcher thing she had. That she used to catch that armadillo thing, that little baby dinosaur. She could have had that. That would have been useful at many points in this movie if she was wielding that.
But it's clear that it doesn't occur to them to have her be anything other than the love interest for Yor.
Well, she's primarily a sex object. I mean, the first time like Yor saves her, and then immediately after that, what does she do? She gets up and she does basically a belly dance for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's always scantily clad like every other woman.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, except for the one who's the scientist.
To be fair, Yor is technically scantily clad if we count his very prominent man pecs.
Oh no, he's man candy. I mean, he's he man.
Yeah.
He has pectation.
He pectates with the best of them.
He was the first pectator.
No, he's actually a future pectator. He's probably the son of Jacob.
No. Yes.
The son of Jacob is going to be a skit now.
Except he's not, because he's like Aryan, so whatever.
The son of Jacob is going on my note right now. The son of Jacob. Thank you, Julia. Thank you. Coming to a theater near you.
So what about the rest of you?
Well, we'll go to Paul.
Okay, my first dislike is very similar to Julia's. It takes most of it. I could have done without Kala and Roa, only defined as their relationship to Yor. Once Roa is basically rescued, then they have that catfight scene. The only thing they seem to want is Yor.
Yeah.
They don't seem to have any other desires whatsoever. The movie does, I don't know if you noticed, Julia, pass the Bechdel test in the most thin pot way possible.
When does that happen?
Kala asks Roa something before they go talk to Yor, and it has nothing to do with Yor. It's like something like where you're from or something like that, or what do you think you're doing?
Does that conversation last like 30 seconds?
No.
Then it doesn't pass.
Okay.
Because they're supposed to like actually have a
conversation.
Okay. And then the movie fridges Roa, and I really got annoyed by that.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to come up in one of my later dislikes as well.
So, I mean, that whole triangle dynamic really pissed me off. And I was thinking, well, I think Julia has helped me see these things that I didn't pay attention to before. I thank you for that. I now can't unsee this crap.
Yeah, sorry.
It does seem to work very hard to Fridger, because, I mean, at first it conks her on the head with a stalagmite, and stalactite, rather, and she bounces back from that pretty easily before it then takes her out of the dramatically useful moment.
Which is how this film does a lot of its narrative tension, is have dramatic moments that are very convenient for furthering the plot. But, I mean, because...
I mean, but there's nothing else that does that. Doctor Who.
Oh, Doctor Who does
I mean, classic
lot.
Doctor Who. This was a lot like classic Doctor Who, and I think that's part of the holdover from being based on, you know, a miniseries TV type thing. It had lots of little incidents and cliffhangers and dramatic moments.
Yeah, you could chop it up into four parts quite easily, I think.
Yeah, and you could see where they would leave, you know, the cliffhanger ending. Like, what's going to happen? How are they going to get out of this one?
Yeah.
Tune in next time on Your Hunter from the Future.
Dun, dun, dun! Dinosaur attack. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. What about you, David?
I have to say, so we're doing likes or dislikes here?
Dislikes. We gotta get through this, yeah.
All right. Julia covered one of mine, too. I guess so. The continuity is all over the map, which occasionally, is violated in order also to further the plot. So, axe gets broken by the Dimetrodon in that attack. We see it snapped in half by the dinosaur's mouth. In the next shot, as they walk away from the defeated monster, he's got his weapon back. And then Pag, for instance, says, "Oh, I have to go get my weapons," which he, for some reason, left in the cave with the transmitter. And when we'd never seen him go to the cave in the first place, and why he would put them there in this place where the devastating explosion happened is never explained. It's just it's necessary to get him to that cave, even though we've had no reason to suspect he'd ever been near there in the first place, or why he would use that as his storage cabinet.
Yeah.
Some of the violations of any kind of common sense I found delightful. Those ones, not as much.
Yeah. At one point, when they suddenly are in the Badlands again, they suddenly have sprouted all these furs. Where the heck did they get those furs from? They weren't wearing the spurs in the previous scene.
And then 2 minutes later, we're told about how difficult life is in this arid desert. And everyone relies so much on water because it's so hot. Well, why are they wearing the furs?
Exactly.
They're special cooling furs.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah. They're futuristic furs that cool.
They're ice furs.
Right. You put them in the freezer and take them out when you need them.
You just hang them on the ice sheets that have mysteriously formed in the desert.
Right.
Oh, cool. Now you're getting into one of my likes, actually.
Oh.
I'm not going into the details there. But no, I think the reason why Pag left those weapons in the cave is because he didn't want any of those people in that place to find his weapons. And he was like, well, they'll never go here where the transmitter box that they're afraid of explosion is going to be.
That makes sense,
but it's never really explained in the movie. Or we have never seen him put them there in the first place.
I mean, I know. I just enjoy coming up with fan wink.
And it's not only... so much a cave as a corner, too.
It's a corner that's been, like, spray-painted red and yellow.
Pag is the only character in this whole movie who's discovered, other than the futuristic-y people we'll come to later, I'm sure, he's the only one who's discovered long-range combat.
Yes.
For some reason, only he has discovered it. No other tribe has. They're all, like, shocked when he uses it.
Well, everybody in this world is unique because when Yor introduces himself, he says, "I'm Yor, the hunter," presumably, therefore, the only one on the planet.
It's true.
Well, to be fair, like, with a name like Yor, I can't imagine many people named Yor in this world since they're only 112.
I think there is an explanation for that, all of that, but I'm not going to get into it now.
There is a kind of explanation for where he comes from.
Yeah, but no, he's
the
hunter.
No, I think there's an explanation for everybody on the planet and how they don't seem to have very much knowledge.
Oh.
And yet, nonetheless, Pag does take to firing a laser rifle like a fish to water.
Oh, yeah.
Not. Which, a plot device that would subsequently be taken up by Battlefield Earth.
Yeah,
well,
that's right.
Pag is special because Pag is destined to be Yor's best friend.
Oh, okay.
I do like Pag. But anyway, that's getting ahead of myself.
All right, so what's your first dislike?
My first dislike, okay, here's the deal. I don't understand the future people. When they get to the place and he's like, they've got all these lasers and these androids and there's the Overlord and he like is tall and British and just evil for no apparent reason. Like, I don't understand how this society has survived as long as it has, which must at least be 20 years, because I'm guessing at the very least, Yor is 20. I mean, is that fair? Like, at the fair very enough. Least he's 20, maybe he's probably 30?
I think 20 is a good way to describe him.
Yeah, oh. I would say he's in his 20s.
Okay. Well, in 20-something years, this futuristic Aryan society has somehow survived, but the more I think about this society, the less it makes any sense. Like, we're like told at one point that, so all of it just doesn't make any sense, but like seriously, like, so nobody at this island has any concept of like long-term consequences for anything they're actually doing. So, like, the people that are rebelling, right, they're like living underground and they're like doing stuff, but not really doing anything. And for somehow weird overlord dude doesn't know they're there, but like he has to know they're there because he's got surveillance everywhere. He's not actually doing much of anything. And I don't think he has actually thought through this whole plan of his where he's going to turn everybody into androids or use Yor's blood to create androids that'll take over the world. And then he'll be does he not have friends?
No, he doesn't need friends. He has power.
Everyone needs friends. Everyone needs like a chess partner. Like Sean, even Magneto has a friend, and
he has a robot army. Those are his friends. He's a Sith Lord.
And they're Darth robots, right? Because
of all the helmets and the special armor. Yes.
Yeah, it does. Like, okay, so like at the end when the evil bad guy, like, he can become immaterial temporarily. But then he conveniently doesn't become immaterial when he's about to get stabbed. Like, why would you get in the elevator knowing you could be stabbed through the elevator?
He's not immaterial.
Because he has
there.
To press the button.
Yeah, the other ones are projections.
Yeah, like, he is literally a Sith Lord. Basically, my theory is that he watched Star Wars and somehow he had an archived copy of it somewhere. And he watched it and he really liked it and he sympathized with Darth Vader and thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if Darth Vader actually won and ruled the world? Maybe I'll model my robot army in his image and become the coolest Sith Lord of all time who rules the world.
That's that would also explain why he has a reverb unit implanted into his larynx.
You have to have that if you're the Underlord.
Yeah, so he can have that voice without actually having a mask.
But how does Yor know that it's not his? That's not one of the projections?
Because he's told him that he has to press the button. So there's this time crunch thing where he has to press this specific button in a specific place.
Right, which goes back to my thing. This guy is so stupid, he doesn't know how to create like a distraction. Like, project 19 different versions of yourself all going towards the button at the same time.
Well, presumably he didn't have the resource for that.
He has fucking androids.
They're all being shut down on him. They're Why are we defending this?
I don't know. I'm not defending it.
I have no idea why we're defending it, but I'm kind of enjoying it.
And like, okay, so like, okay, let's move beyond this. Let's move back to the fact that the island gets destroyed at the end, right? Like, they plant the bomb, and then Yor leaves, and the evil bad guy gets killed. But like, almost all of the other future people die too, right?
Well, the ones who leave the island, but the ones who die are self-sacrifices.
Right. So like most of them die though.
Yeah, but they know that there's a whole world out there with other people because that's where Yor came from, and they know that they're sending some people with Yor.
But what happens to the plane that he flies away in? Like, they just fly into the sunset. So like,
it tells you over the credits, Yor flies back to the mainland and joins the tribes on the periphery and makes a new world.
Yeah.
But what does that mean?
Will he succeed? I don't know. Maybe we'll have to watch the next Yor movie.
That they're going to bring the values of and goodness of the technology of the Aryan people to the tribes and fight against barbarians and dinosaurs and everything else.
Okay, let me ask you another question then. Androids. Why?
Because he can control them.
And they can shoot lasers.
Evil bad guy. Why is he evil?
Because he's evil. Sean, why is any evil overlord evil?
Because it's fun.
But here's, like, I just don't understand. Like, why does he want to take over the world? He's got an island all to his fucking self, and he can like hang out with his androids. They can play chess together. Like,
but
they
doesn't want to play chess. He wants to control the whole world. That's, and like, he is doing other stuff. He's experimenting on all the other humans.
Right, but he's got androids who can do anything he wants them to do.
No, they can't. That's the point. Didn't you catch that part of the problem? The androids are not very clever or very sophisticated. That's why he wants yours blood, so he can use it and mix it with. Oh God, I'm drinking.
He wants an army of cyborgs.
He wants an army of cyborgs or androids with yours and Kala's DNA in it, so that they can have even better minions. That's okay. What he wants. He could care less about the blonde haired people who obviously are a thorn in his side. He wants people he can control, but not stupid people he can control, which is what he has now.
None of this Aryan robots. It doesn't make it. Okay, shush. That's another thing I'll be talking about later. It just doesn't make any sense, and I don't understand. I kind of just find myself very tired of this trope of like evil people are just evil because they're evil. Like I'm capable of being evil, but I feel like if I figured out how to make androids that can do stuff, I would just make them better androids, and then I would just live on my island, and I would like have Mai Tais.
See, this is why you're not a supervillain, Sean.
Because that would be the extent
to it. And it's one of the reasons why I still talk to you.
But like, why would I need the whole world? I don't need it. I have
yes,
android servants.
If you
servants.
Thought you needed the whole world and were actually a supervillain, we would not be friends.
But why do supervillains ever need the whole world? They don't actually literally need it.
Because
John,
they're
if you have to ask, you'll never
power.
Understand.
Yeah,
that's my point. I don't understand the super bad guy. I don't get his motivations. He's like, he's just like, I'm an evil British dude because I'm evil.
Do you understand supervillains in any other movie?
Yes, I understand Dr. Horrible.
Okay, like, but basically, we don't know that guy's backstory. We can assume he has your standard supervillain backstory.
No, we can't assume anything because this movie doesn't make any sense.
We didn't know Darth Vader's backstory in the first Star Wars.
Right, but he was just an evil bad guy. But we learned that he was the father of Luke Skywalker, and so
not
when we got to the end,
not
in the first film,
not in the first film. And like,
not
honestly,
no, but we didn't.
How
need
do
to.
You know? How do you know that the evil overlord isn't yours' father?
And okay, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to defend Star Wars right now because you all brought it up, and it's on like Donkey Kong. Okay, first off, in the first film, while we don't find out he is his father, we are told by Obi-Wan Kenobi that Darth Vader is fallen. Like, he tells us this at some point. I can't remember when because I haven't seen the movie in a long time. Right? We know that Darth Vader and he have old history together, that there is more to him than just simply just – he's just like a guy in a creepy suit and he talks funny.
But we don't know what it is.
Yeah, we don't know what it is.
And we
also
don't need
like,
to, like you said.
In the first Harry Potter book, Voldemort is just a big bad for no reason. And we eventually, over the course of the 7 books, learn Voldemort's entire backstory. But basically, he's just kind of always been evil, even as a kid.
There's not a terrible lot of character development of the title character from The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, right.
Who's the Lord of the Rings?
Sauron.
He's not really the Lord. He sucks.
But his character
development.
He's
the big bad that they have to defeat.
Yeah.
And there's no real reason for it that we know.
Elsewhere, but
why does Sauron want to conquer the world and not just sit in Mordor?
Because everyone else is racist as frick in this world. Like, he's got this horrible land that's got no vegetation. It's terrible. He's got all these orc people. Everybody is just mean to them because they're kind of ugly looking and they look different. And he's just like, dudes, you got all this cool land with like corn and horses and stuff, and I want some of that for my people. That's what this is about.
Which he could have like done through trade or some other thing, but no, he decides to like get a bunch of rings and make people corrupted by power, and yeah, no.
This is because Sauron really liked dress up, and he liked to look really nice in his like cool armor and stuff.
Well, the
and
evil
he liked
overlord really likes dress
people.
Up and robots.
He made gifts for people. He made gifts with like magic rings, but then of course the problem was is everyone else is stupid and they just misuse the rings and get obsessed like freaking Bilbo.
But those
Sauron
rings are specifically
is the hero.
Made to corrupt everyone.
That's just a lie. That's just elven propaganda. Okay, first off, Sauron is the tragic hero of the movie, and you need to get this straight.
So if I follow this rabbit hole that we've fallen down correctly, we've gone from on one side those of us defending the motivation of the Overlord and you're the hunter from the future to Sean justifying the ways of Sauron to man in The Lord of the Rings.
This has been the most surreal torture cinema that I've been on, and it's not even halfway over. And we have officially broken Paul.
We have broken Paul. That's great. Okay.
So where does Warhammer fit into this? Because I feel like David could speak to that.
Oh, well, there's justification all over the place. It's, you know, the Horus's issues with his father, and we get all kinds of Paradise Lost and quotations from the New Testament leading into his breakdown. So we got justifications up the wazoo in the Horus Heresy. We got like 30 volumes so far setting up that, all that stuff.
I bet we do for the Overlord. We just haven't seen them.
Exactly. It's all in the comic book. It's extra diegetic to the movie, but it's all there.
Great. Okay, I think we can move to our second leg now.
I think we can.
I like that we're only on our second leg.
I know.
Okay.
We're crazy. All right.
So it's me, right?
Yeah, it's you.
Yeah, dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They're actual sculptures, and they're dinosaurs, and that was awesome.
And that happens to be my like as well. Because the dinosaurs were like the best thing of this whole thing. Like he fights a Triceratops.
It's not a Triceratops. It's a Triceratops Stegosaurus cross. Yes.
I'm sorry.
It's like a Triceratops.
Stegostops or something. Yeah.
Stegatops.
Even more awesome.
The Stegatops.
Tristegatops?
Yeah, Stegatops.
It was amazing, regardless,
yeah.
And I really enjoyed seeing, like, because this wasn't high budget, but, like, they clearly actually made those creatures, and that always makes me happy.
Yeah, and I did think that they used them, considering that they didn't have very good range of motion, they're fairly limited, I thought that, and I hate to give this film too many compliments, because it's not a well-shot film, I think they used them well, given the limitations of the tools.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as good as Godzilla, but it was still fun.
Yeah, I would agree there. All right, well, we're done, I guess, unless anyone wants to add anything, because the dinosaurs were kick-ass.
Oh, yeah, they were awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was cool. How many movies do you see that where a Stegoceratopsin fight, right?
And a Dimetrodon, yeah, which is not technically a dinosaur, but...
Nope.
That's okay. Well, what about you, Paul? Was yours the same?
I had it on my list, so I'll just piggyback.
Sweet, awesome, David.
Well, mine's related, and that's the dinosaurs were part of it. The overall all-in quality of the film, like it just committed to its special effects, whether or not they were any good. Right, they were absolutely shameless. And I remember, like when that papier-mâché dinosaur showed up in the first 5 minutes, and it's like, yes, you know, this is art, citizens and taxpayers, this is cinema. And then when we get the floods and the fire and the earthquakes and laser beams and the spaceship, and it's like, you know, we've got $1.98 on the budget, but we're not going to hide any of this. And we're just going to show you and show you and show you. And I really, really appreciated that.
I totally agree. 100%.
Yeah.
Agreed.
What was that flying thing that you rode
on? Oh, yes.
On?
Yes. The bat hang glide thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. It was like a giant bat.
That
he's turned into a hang glider.
And he shoots it down, and then he just, like, grabs it, and he flies it.
Yes!
And like, that other little bit.
Because that's totally how giant bat carcasses work. You can just fly them.
Fun things we've learned.
That kind of Casio Carmina Burana thing happening when he, because we get the chant there and in the trapeze scene later on, where it sounds like there's on the track, it's majestic and exciting, and I'm not really sure they were words. It's just punching up the ridiculous spectacle that you've seen with a ridiculous soundtrack.
Yeah, plus also another call out for the special effects when they have the one place, the one group of people steals Kala, and they walk her over this rickety bridge, and there's like a gratuitous shot downward into the moat that they're walking over, which is full of writhing snakes, and she's like really scared, and it's the cheesiest special effect ever, but they're totally 100% committed to the fact that they made these snakes out of clay and they are writhing.
Yes.
I thought they were eels.
Whatever.
No, I thought they were snakes.
Snails.
Snails.
I mean, eels are basically water snakes, whatever.
Fair enough. Eels are nasty creatures.
It was like 2 inches of water, and it had a bunch of wriggling clay in it.
Oh. I didn't.
But it worked.
Yeah, but it worked. Because I believed it.
And that flood was awesome. I mean, you know, especially if it can be triggered by removing one stick. You know, he's playing Jenga and destroys his culture. You know,
yeah, that's, I want to talk about that flood later, though.
All right.
Excellent. All right, well, we have gone through our second like, so let's jump to our second dislike. So, Julia, second dislike.
My second dislike is, okay, cavemen. So we have, like, a bunch of different tribes of people who are not necessarily cavemen, and then there are specifically cavemen, and the cavemen are, like, evil people who are super dirty and gross and have bad teeth and boils, and they always try to steal, like, Kala and any other woman that they can get their hands on and do evil things to them.
Mostly involving making them run in circles.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just, like, okay. So it's a world in which you have multiple tribes who are not full of dirty, disgusting people. Why are the cavemen all completely disgusting? And just, I don't know. They seemed gratuitous. Mm. I like, you didn't buy the Overlord. I didn't buy the cavemen.
I had this weird, like, this is the thing, is I never really understood the future thing for, like, and so, like, I understood that it said he's from the future. So I thought, like, he had been, like, transported back in time. For most of this, so I actually thought of the cavemen people as, like, they're, like, the Neanderthals. I mean, not literally, but, like, that they're the Neanderthals, and that was what's going on, is it's a conflict between these people and the more hunter-gatherer types of the new Homo sapiens. But that was giving a lot of credit to the film.
I mean, it's all easily explained away by the grand unified theory of the Overlord, which is that he's basically Dr. Moreau, and the mainland is his island full of tribes that he has created to do psychological experiments on. So, like, theoretically, he was like, wouldn't it be cool if we had gross cavemen? I'll make some of those, too.
Well, that would explain why those cavemen all look exactly like Bela Lugosi from The Island of Lost Souls.
There you
yes,
go.
Yes, it would.
But yeah, like, it seems to me that the clear thing that's going on here is that the Overlord has a deep interest in, like, human psychology and behavior, and has decided to make a bunch of different tribes, and that's why they all act in very stereotypically similar ways. Like, each tribe is made of people who are all very similar to each other and are like, now we will do this, and we do not, for some reason, have knowledge that extends beyond this small set of knowledge that we have, even though we could. And we don't trade or share with any other tribe, even though we are very close to other tribes.
You know what? The Overlord.
It's because they're all being controlled by the Overlord.
The Overlord is Arthur Frame from Zardoz.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
exactly. Manipulating all the stuff outside of their little perfect world, although his world's far from perfect. He's Arthur Frame. He's been mucking around with the mainland all this time.
Yep. Pretty much. And that's why he wants to create a new race with Yor and Kala, where he's, like, decided that they're the perfect DNA, but, you know, it's not actually going to be perfect, and then he's going to want to kill them, too. So, like, that's the thing, because the evil Overlord keeps sending his robots and spaceships to go kill people, because he's like, oh, this tribe isn't actually perfect. They're not how I envisioned them, so I'm going to kill them.
And one nice thing about the cavemen, though, is the as if I heard correctly, the main bad caveman was named Khan. And then we had that moment when Yor is yelling, damn you, Khan. And, you know, that was a pretty nice moment.
I remember that
was a great moment.
And that was – I laughed out loud because that was the most ridiculous part of the movie, is him going, Khan!
He didn't say Khan. He was like, damn you, Khan.
Yeah.
And that was it. And
basically.
Like, clearly that was the moment where he should have been like, Khan!
I know. That was what was going on in my head, though, was him going, Khan! But, you know, it would be dubbed over with, like, an Italian voice. Because why not?
But, like, even so, like, I just – I can understand why the Overlord created all the other tribes. They were okay. The cavemen, I just don't even understand why the Overlord would have created them. Bad marks, no grade for you. You fail your tribe creation test.
I mean, it was like just like an early attempt, right? You know, sort of rough sketch, didn't work out so well. You know, level one, his sim tyrant level hadn't moved up too high there.
I disagree, though, in some ways. In some ways, those cavemen are the most successful and tenacious of all the peoples we see. We see them attack the quote unquote peaceful tribe, whose tribe we don't get name, pretty successfully. They have a concerted and well thought out plan of attack. They take out all the guards.
Why do they never bathe? Why are their teeth horrible and why are they covered in boils?
Because they dammed up all their water so that they couldn't be wiped out by it subsequently.
No, there's just a flaw. There are many flaws in this logic.
And even after Yor does the flood thing, we still have Khan and company coming after him. And they are
a tenacious and gross breed.
Yes. I
object to the grossness. I think it's gratuitous grossness that doesn't need to exist.
Okay.
They're really just like the Overlord, though.
It's the Overlord is clean.
Right, that's the problem.
He actually bathes. They have a bunch of water. They keep it dammed up. Why aren't they, like, swimming in it?
Maybe he didn't teach them how to swim. And they drown.
Yes.
I mean, they clearly didn't survive the flooding. Like, that whole tribe
Saying that they weren't tenacious and that they weren't some of the most successful people in the movie from killing people. I'm just saying, like, they were gross and I didn't see why they had to be gross.
No, I agree. They don't have to be gross. There's no real reason for it.
Yeah, and like they should have enough skill and talent that they could be clean if they wanted to, and they clearly don't want to for some reason.
I just feel like they might be misunderstood.
I like how now you're defending the cavemen.
I can't actually. They're really horrible. They're terrible, disgusting creatures. Which is exactly the point that's being made in the film, and it's really kind of lazy. So I agree with you, Julia. But in any case, Paul?
Yep, my second dislike, and we've talked about it, and now I'm going to go into full detail. Let's talk about that flood scene for a moment and how awful and ridiculous and bad it is. So Yor finds one little thing to move to cause this entire thing to flood, which shows A, the cavemen have bad engineering, or B, Yor is lucky, or C, just a very bad script. So what do we see happen? We see the water go up. We see this water flood, and what are the results? I mean, ostensibly what we see is most of the cavemen die except for Khan and a couple others, right?
Also the women that were
exactly
with
my point. Yor not only kills the cavemen, he just killed all the women from the tribe that he had just been captured before, and possibly other women that they probably had from other tribes. Yor is a mass murderer.
Is constantly like bringing destruction wherever he goes.
Well, yes, hence my tagline. But in this case, it's even worse because it's not that he shows up and bad things happen, like say at the beach when Pak accidentally summons the orbital strike. But here he actively floods the chasm and kills all the cavemen and all the women from the village, and no one ever calls him on his crap.
Well, I think perhaps we need to consider the possibility then that this film is actually a very serious-minded parable of Western colonialism and patriarchy, in that we have this exaggeratedly Aryan ubermensch who travels the world taking women as his due, visiting one distinct culture after another, leaving quite literally flood, fire, and earthquake in his wake.
Right, but in the end, he is the savior who gets to like live and start the new world again. So, well, I think maybe it is that commentary, except that it's still actually in favor of it.
Or rather, a deeply pessimistic one. It's, you know, like 1984, in that this an unstoppable force of destruction is quite literally unstoppable.
The blonde Ubermensch cannot be tamed or controlled.
Yes, and it would just go around in this perpetual cycle of destruction, coming from a culture that has destroyed the world already.
I don't think the movie doesn't like him, though, because everyone who's in the movie actually wants Yor to succeed.
Well, no, there's absolutely no way that I can sustain this reading of it.
it's an amusing reading of it, to be sure. But yeah, it's just like, I mean, for all the destruction he causes, this is the worst because he does it explicitly on his own. I mean, the village gets attacked and destroyed, but that's not his fault. He was just there.
Well, like, I think that he made a calculated decision at that point, and he's just like, well, you know, if I don't kill all of these women, then the cavemen are still going to be loose, and if I save them, I'm going to have to, like, find a way to stop the cavemen and to provide for all these women. And honestly, like, I've got enough babes and I can't be doing that. So
nobody mentions them ever again.
Better if I just kill them all and then the cavemen will be gone. And they were an unfortunate sacrifice, but at least they're no longer my responsibility at the end.
Right. Like, they could have addressed that, you know, had them be a little upset or something, you know, you'd be like, I wasn't really related with them. We just kind of like found them, but like, you know, they were kind of all right. And that sucks. But no, we don't even get that much.
I mean, they're Kala and Pax fellow tribesmen in there who just get wiped out by Yor's insanity.
They seem to be okay with it.
I don't think that Kala and Pag actually liked their tribe. They were just like, whatever, Yor's awesome. We're going to go with him.
Well, certainly Kala doesn't, because she gets really upset by the traditions of the tribe at one point.
And there's some weird, and it's just some very weird going on now. I'm going off on a tangent about the tribe that they're in. First of all, I don't know how they survived as long as they have since they got so wiped out so easily. They're relatively, I mean, it's almost like a, now I'm going to sound like Dave, almost sounds like a criticism of a pacifism, because they get pwned pretty easily by the cavemen. I mean pathetically, I mean, without Yor they would have stood no chance, and even with Yor there, it's nearly a total wipeout.
Yeah.
Not to mention they say something about it's a blink and you miss it. They say something about Kala being the daughter of the king. Like, what king?
No, so who? She was the daughter of the former king.
Former king. So here's the thing.
There's like basically a Hamlet scenario has played out in that tribe, and so now the person who's leading the tribe is basically like Claudius, and Kala is basically like Hamlet, except that since she's a woman, she doesn't get to have even the active mope that Hamlet gets. So she just has she's just basically got Polonius looking after her, and that's Pog. And Pog is like basically like, I was friends with your dad and I really liked him, so I'm going to like actually help you out and look after you. And they don't like anyone else in the tribe because they don't trust those people.
Wait.
That's a really deep reading, Julia.
Wait.
That's it. That's the solution.
Wait. You're saying Pog is
Polonius?
But Hamlet kills Polonius.
Excellent. Right, but Polonius is like actually trying to be on Hamlet's side. And in this case, have rolled Hamlet and Ophelia into one character, and she's not Polonius's daughter. She's the daughter of the former king.
Well, I don't think Polonius – oh, I'm sorry. We're going to have a whole argument about Shakespeare.
Polonius was Ophelia's father, and he loved Ophelia. And Hamlet didn't mean to kill Polonius.
No, he thought it was Claudius.
He was hiding behind the heiress.
But he was
and he thought that he was Claudius, so he stabs him. But then like when he works out that he's killed his future father-in-law, he's not happy about that. He didn't mean to do that. That guy was basically a nice guy.
Well, he actually just calls him a fool, isn't he? He just says, "Oh, yeah, this idiot shouldn't have been there."
Right.
Yeah.
And Polonius was working for Claudius when he was behind the arrows.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going to say.
But he was definitely in favor of protecting Ophelia and Laertes.
Yeah, oh, that's something.
Because they were
true.
His children. So basically what we have in Kala is a hybrid of Hamlet and Ophelia, but she's not Polonius's daughter. She's the daughter of the former king. And Polonius is loyal to the former king and looks at her as a daughter figure.
Yeah. I'm starting to think then that the Overlord is actually Lear, the way he's divided up the world.
She's just like a bizarre.
Well, the
like,
Overlord might be Lear. The king of the tribe was Claudius, though.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah.
I am so confused. There's like way too much Shakespeare. Let's get back to like somebody make a fart joke. Like we need to get this back to the level.
Oh, Shakespeare did lots of fart jokes.
There we go. Give
like
me a Shakespearean
fart joke. The whole
of The
Tempest is basically one big fart joke.
I think David's second dislike.
Go yeah.
Well, I guess though I appreciated, again, as I said, the all-in quality of the climaxes, and the fact that they came fairly frequently, the film didn't actually handle the picaresque quality particularly well, and that in between the climaxes, there was a lot of wandering around. You felt the meander, and so on the one hand, there was a lot of stuff happening, but in between the stuff, there was a lot of nothing happening.
That makes sense. It's very choppy that way. Attack! Attack!
So yeah, so the pace was very stuttery, and so there were the things that were made the film wildly entertaining were punctuated by bits that made the film seem longer than it actually was.
Yeah, to me that felt pretty consistent with epics like The Odyssey.
Yeah,
you have like
fair
all
enough.
Sorts of the Odyssey is just a series of stories, but there are a lot of parts of those stories before the thing that happens in them, where it's just like Odysseus is doing something. Odysseus is hanging out on an island,
yeah,
for a while.
Well, actually, no, you're absolutely right, and I guess what I would say there too is that those moments that we get, which I guess could even be straight out of that, like are so. So standard issue, all right? He's rescued the people. Now we'll have the feast, and there'll be the dance, and all of which was quite indifferently staged. There would be other moments where some of the visual imagination of the film would really kick in, but those bits would be, particularly the feast and Kala's seductive dancing. I mean, that was pretty soporific.
Oh, that annoyed me so much, that scene.
Oh, like, what about the point where he's with Roa by the waterfall and she's like, I have never desired you. I've never desired a man the way I desire you.
Yes.
Well,
and then he looks at Roa and he's like, you look fine.
Yeah.
Let's see that snake at each other for a while.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of... my brain has too much beer. That kind of reminds me of... your favorite torture cinema movie.
Are you thinking of Birdemic?
I'm thinking of Birdemic.
Because my favorite torture cinema movie is Sons of Steel, but Birdemic is a close second.
Yeah, okay. That kind of reminds me of Birdemic and how the protagonist of Birdemic is just not all there.
No, he's not.
Your is very similar that way. I mean, he does not have the highest IQ in the box of crayons,
and yet he somehow figures out how to solve puzzles.
I don't know.
I don't understand it.
He maybe just rolls right
well because he is He-Man or Prince Adam, and they go to the Castle of Grayskull at one point. I mean, it's all in there. I was waiting for Skeletor to arrive. Unfortunately, he never did.
And on in those equivalent characters and or his being other figures, did I hear correctly? There was a bit of dialogue where we were told that his real name was Galahad.
Yes,
Galahad, yes.
It wasn't just me then. All right.
No, he was Galahad, son of Asgard.
Yes.
What?
Galahad, son of Asgard.
I missed the Asgard part.
They only say the Galahad like once or twice. They at one point they call him after that. They call him your son of Asgard. It's like, yeah.
I get it. You're son of Asgard?
No, you're the son of Asgard.
No, you're the son of Asgard. What are you talking about?
That kind of reminds me of an old prisoner joke.
Which I won't get because I'm not
you won't get.
Prisoner.
Who was number one? You are number six. David gets that.
Yes, I am not a number.
I get it.
All right, what about you, David?
So what are we up to now? Delights or dislikes?
We just did,
I think just
we
did
just
me.
Did David.
But, yeah, I think
turn,
we're on to...
Was it my turn?
Yep.
Okay, so what have we covered?
We've wandered all over the map.
We have, like, this is the most, like, running off hilarious episode we've ever done. Like, it's just so much depth. It's just delicious. Okay, so I'll just do my counterpoint to my dinosaurs, because like I really love the dinosaurs. I think just because that Triceratopsosaurus, Stegotops, whatever. I love that scene, but then there are moments when like I could accept the first time the Triceratops Stegotopsin right shows up, and it's like they have to fight it, and it's like, okay, this is convenient, so he'll meet the people, and then like whatever, blah 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 blah, right? All that's real convenient, it's fine. But then every time a dinosaur shows up, it's these super convenient times to further the plot, and oftentimes I get that they're like trying to make it adventurous, but they're also just stupid. They're really dumb. So like, as much as it's adorable to use a dead giant bat creature dinosaur as a hang glider, it's also just monumentally dumb.
Well, it worked.
And like, I saw it coming.
And you've never seen something like that before in your life.
No, I'm sorry. There's a reason why I haven't ever seen anything like that, because that's just stupid. But like, I saw it coming and I was like, please don't like pick it up and just fly it. Like it's not going to work. You're going to fall to your death. You know, it's going to be really horrible. You're just going to be like a character from like a skit out of Family Guy. You're going to be screaming because your leg's broken. And then the cave people are going to come up and they're like just like going to eat your face or something horrible. Don't do it. And then he does it and like he just magically glides across as though flapping wing. Like in this world, this future world, gravity does not apply anymore. And birds don't have to flap wings to fly.
I can have a theory that explains that.
Oh, don't no.
Maybe we don't need that digression.
Is it the theory about how Yor is magic? His perfect DNA gives him magic powers.
No, kind of, sort of. It explains. It's a grand unified theory of why this world is so screwed up as the way it is. It's clearly a post-scarcity, post-singularity fall universe, where we had a singularity and then civilization collapsed, which explains why we have things like returned dinosaurs, weird strains of humans, mixings of technology, humans that can't build anything because they've lost all their ability to know anything. That's why they've gone back to the Stone Age. They clearly reached the singularity, had a post-scarcity culture, and then it went kaplooey. And so people who left is all left of mist. I mean, they must have brought back the dinosaurs at some point just for kicks, or maybe it was the Overlord who did it. And that's why you have cavemen, you have sand people, you have these pastoral tribes. That's why you have this chock-a-block sort of thing, and why the terrain makes no sense in this movie either. It's clearly the Earth has been sculpted and re-sculpted by the heights of the former post-singularity culture that's now gone away.
That is just way too deep for this damn movie, Paul.
We've gone deep in this episode.
I know. So it's a Shakespearean like homage. It's a Hitlerian analog. I mean, it's just like, wow. This is putting those MST3K whatever people to shame. Like, they have never gotten this deep in their commentary.
I think that's what happens when you have a movie that's such a grand pastiche that you can really just pick and choose whatever you want to say about it and then go off on random tangents.
Massive rabbit-holy tangents.
Which is pretty awesome for 83 minutes.
I know.
I feel like we could probably take this podcast and turn it into a PhD.
Well, I mean, the podcast's already longer than the movie.
Uh-huh. No, like we could clearly turn this podcast, all of the different things that we've done, into a PhD on the study of Yor.
Oh, for sure.
I'm sorry, what does PhD stand for?
Piled higher and deeper.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I know that joke. I'm not even in academia, I know that joke.
I feel really dumb all of a sudden. I cannot believe I didn't make that connection. I'm so dumb, because my grandma says that all the time. How are you doing with your piled high and deeper? Yeah. Yeah, I'm really stupid right now. I've had a lot of drinks.
I took what Julia said at face value.
You know, I actually I'm actually serious. We could turn this into the next best related work. We could write a book.
We should. That would be great.
That's a scary process.
The greatest movie most people have never seen.
podcasters dig You're the Hunter from the Future. I bet Mad Norwegian would do it.
Sigrid! Oh, Sigrid, we have a book for you.
Oh, man, that would be hilarious. But in any case, why don't we jump to... I think we're on our third likes.
We only are on our third likes.
Oh, man, we're never going to get out of this.
All right, third likes, Julie, go.
Okay, so I really liked that your the voice dubbing for your was just fluent English. It didn't sound broken. It didn't sound particularly wooden. He was just like, hey, we could use this. Or look at this thing over here, which sounded like normal English. And I imagine that, like, in this world, they're not actually speaking our modern English. They're speaking some other language that they all know because it's a far future language that we don't have. But they've translated it for our benefit. And so that's why it's dubbed. But, like, I like the fact that since they are clearly speaking in the languages that they are fluent in, what we hear is him being fluent and not him speaking broken English.
Mm. That's a fair point.
Fair enough.
I actually have a completely different third like. I know I've been piggybacking. So I liked this film was filmed on location in Turkey, and I loved as bonkers and disjointed as the scenery is, because they clearly did different parts of Turkey, nowhere near close or related to each other. I liked the terrain. We get some lovely Cappadocian badlands. We get some forest. We get some nice forested, eroded areas. We have a wonderful little beach area. I love the terrain. The waterfall area. This is some lovely scenery in this movie. I mean, they could have filmed it a little better and at better times of the day rather than high noon when things got washed out. That really annoyed me as a photographer. You should have been filming this more towards sunrise and sunset, but don't get me started. But it's lovely. It's a lovely terrain, because I'm looking at the Badlands. Okay, Badlands, where is this? Is this American West? And then when I saw the credits of Turkey, oh, okay, yes, Cappadocia. Okay, that makes sense. Because I was thinking maybe it was filmed in the Badlands and in the coast of Oregon, maybe when we get to the coast. But no, it's all Turkey, and it's gorgeous scenery, and I love it.
Perfect. All right, what about you, David?
Well, a little bit related to that is some of the visual imagination of the film. There are moments of full on delirium and of making things strange that I think worked very well. So things like a lot of these things didn't necessarily make any sense, but that was fine. So when Yor finds Roa, was that her name? The people that she's with all in you know, the chalk white faces with and completely white clothing, with, you know, then the flaming sword and the Y-shaped torches. And
oh yeah,
none of that made any sense, but it looked great. And then in the climax, the final act, when they're in the advanced civilization's base, and we get that scene in the Hall of Mirrors. Now, why is there a Hall of Mirrors there? There's no explanation. What purpose does that scene serve? None. But, it was shot really well, so that the disorientation that the characters were experiencing was, I felt too, in that you started seeing, okay, there's the reflection and there's the actual Yor or the actual Kalad. Oh, wait a minute, no, that's a reflection. And then the other one passes in front. Oh, that's the real person. No, that's a reflection too. That scene was really quite nicely staged, I thought. So the bits where the film starts to become, where it really starts tripping, I thought worked very nicely.
I thought that mirror scene was a ripoff of Conan the Destroyer, but Conan the Destroyer postdates this movie, so it's not a ripoff. But that's what
I thought it reminded me of an episode of Wonder Woman that I watched as a child, which probably did predate this. But, like, a Hall of Mirrors thing is not a new concept.
There was nothing new about the concept at all, but it did it nicely. And again, you know.
Oh, no, I agree with you. And
it was derivative.
And
it
totally
no
agree
sense.
About the stylized cave where he finds Roa, and she's like, they worship me as a goddess because I came from the ice. And they're all like, we are wielding torches and she is our goddess.
That's so weird.
It made no sense, but it did look fantastic.
And for some reason, there was oil there too? I don't know. Yeah, I love the fact that the whole place with ice blew up.
I think the ice was actually plastic and that all of that was petroleum products, which is why everything caught on fire.
Yeah, she mentions that the ice sometimes melts a little and that gives them the water. I think it's Ice Nine myself.
I think it's something similar to Ice Nine, but Ice Nine does not melt.
It's clearly a special form of ice,
it's probably like Ice 8.
Yeah, it's a weird form, but it also goes back to my whole post singularity fall thing. I mean, obviously it's some sort of strange form of ice which was constructed atom by atom by a nanoforge, and it's just a remnant of the fall of the post scarcity singularity culture.
I like that we have now also brought Vonnegut into this. It's important to relate all the important works of science fiction history to this movie.
Oh, you guys. You guys. This has just been a really... It's been a treat. It's been a treat, guys. I just want you to know.
It's not over yet, Sean.
I know. We're only on our third like, which I guess would be...
This is going to be the longest torture cinema we've ever done.
Yeah, it's shaping up. Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, great. I'll just kind of, it'll be related to some things people have already said. And it'll go back to something we were saying when we were talking in the dislikes is even though there are lots of issues with the way it's plotted and those kinds of things, I did love that it is a story with a sort of epic quest narrative. Because we've not really watched much that doesn't sort of get bogged down in lots of just other stuff. This is just kind of, for a lot of it seems very straightforward. Like, he's just trying to find out the information, and so he goes on these quests without a shirt for some reason. And then he just, that's it. It's inconsistent, it's occasionally very flighty, but I liked it, just this idea of dealing with these very broad, questy, sort of epic ideas, even if it wasn't successful. So I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward, nobody can disagree. Awesome. Let us go to our third dislike then, Julia.
So while I liked that Yor talked in fluent English, the downside was that pretty much everyone else in the movie sounded wooden and like an NPC from a video game, where they were all just kind of like, and they had no reason to, like they spoke not broken English, but they spoke it like it wasn't a natural language to them. So they were just like, Yor, you are a hunter from beyond the mountains. And that's kind of a weird way to deliver any line that you would say in a real conversation. It would be as if I mentioned everything that I was saying about this podcast in this way.
I will say to that, though, that you'd encounter that in just about any Italian film from the 50s through the 90s. Yeah,
I agree with that. However, the thing is that since Yor was not talking like that, it really was weirdly glaring. Because Yor would just talk like a normal person, and then everyone else would do this weird stilted dialogue.
Yeah, this is actually one of my dislikes too. So I'll just piggyback on that because I have a line of dialogue from Yor and one from Kala just to show the differences. I am a question burning without an answer. That was Yor. That's fine. That's dandy. And then Kala at one point asks Pog, "Why is Yor different than other men?" It's like my God, I have a very sexist comment to say. Like, yours obviously does not want to listen to dialogue if he actually gets into bed with Kala. I mean, Yor does a lot of bed hopping, or at least tries to in this movie. Or although he does turn down the prepubescent the 17-year-old or whatever she was at the fishing village. I was afraid for a second that she was going to wind up going on the quest and getting killed just like poor Roa.
Yeah, but, I was worried that she was going to be killed by Kala, but then he was like, no, you are a nice child, but I already have a woman. And I was like, that's interesting, because earlier you were totally into having two wives.
He discovers monogamy. Magic.
He reinvents monogamy. But at one point somebody says, well, you only have the one life, and where are your children? So obviously polygamy polygamy is obviously a thing in this world. I wonder if polyandry is as well, but I'm guessing not.
I mean, the polygamy is, but I'm wondering if in the case of Yor, it may be more that he's a serial monogamist, because he doesn't actually, I mean, he appears to drop Kala like a hot coal when he encounters Rhea. And then once she dies, then he goes, then he kind of notices, Kala again.
It's true. He does seem to be a serial monogamist.
Yeah.
It's creepy.
But yeah, the dialogue of everybody except Yor in this movie is just weird, stilted. I mean, he speaks normal, but practically nobody else does. I mean, I can't even tell with the Overlord with his weird British accent and intonations. But everyone else is.
The Overlord is John Steiner, who was in a lot of Italian exploitation films. But maybe a case too where we're hearing the actual voice of Red Brown, but we know we're not hearing the actual voices of Corinne Clery and Luciano Pigozzi, who played Kala and Pag.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like anytime you have a dubbed version of something, because I've seen a lot of movies that have been dubbed. You have the choice of having people read it like it's actual dialogue or not. And although Yor's dialogue reads like it's actual dialogue, everyone else's reads like it's not. Mm-hmm. And that's anytime you watch a cartoon, you're watching dubbed stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree. I guess it's, especially the kind of the low budget world of, that this was emerging from just about any film I can think of from that era and a few decades on either side. That kind of stilted dubbing is just kind of par for the course, right? That, you're lucky. You get a few characters who are sounding naturalistic and then the others that are just sounding, you know, wonky. And I agree completely that it is distract, you know, it stands out. But it's also, it's what you're going to get. And not just in something like Yor, but, you know, anything coming out of the industry at that time.
Mm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I would probably complain about it in most other movies that we watched from this era too.
Fair enough.
Also, I should say at this point, I have a couple of big dislikes for this movie, but other than that, it was kind of hard to come up with some. So this is kind of a, you know, it's small.
Cop out.
it's not a cop out. It's just small.
Small dislike. Fair enough.
So third dislike, David.
Yeah.
Oh, well, as much as I liked the, the delirium that I was talking about before, I wish there had been more. That it could have been even weirder, some of the scenes could have been staged more imaginatively. I mean, there were plenty that I loved, but I guess in some ways, this is like what Julia just said. This is more of a nitpick. And some of the major dislikes have already been covered, and or other things that it would normally be dislikes are actually likes. But I think there could have been even more strangeness to it. Before we began the podcast, Julia, you mentioned Barbarella, and that was, I had this at the back of my mind some of the time too, where that film is consistently weird, 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 weird all the way through. And this could have been that.
Yeah, that's true. I think that it reminded me of two things, as far as live action. One was Barbarella and the other was Sinbad. And I think it was a lot more like Sinbad in the not being weird, but having lots of segmented adventures.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're talking the one with the claymation in it, not the TV
claymation
show.
Oh, the stop motion animation?
Stop motion, sorry. I thought for a minute you meant Sinbad, like the 90s comedian who was in a bunch of movies.
No.
I'm talking about things that I would have seen in the 5 o'clock movie slot when I was a kid.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I know which one you're talking about now, the actual Sinbad. I saw that when I was a kid, and it was awesome and terrified the hell out of me because it had skeleton people.
But it's not as weird as Barbarella.
No, Jason. No, that's Jason and the Argonauts that had the skeleton people.
Oh. There's one skeleton in Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah. Jason and the Argonauts has that awesome scene with the swarm of skeletons. Oh, that is one of the best scenes in all of all of fantasy film, in my opinion.
Oh, well, then I've never seen Sinbad. My life's incomplete.
Julie. Well, unless you might have, if because there is a skeleton fight. It's just one skeleton with a sword in the first.
There is a skeleton fight.
I think it would have been the other one, the Argonauts one, because I remember there being a lot of skeletons and I was scared.
I feel like those are both from the same school of film, though.
Yeah. That's the Harry Harryhausen.
Yeah.
Right.
Housen, yeah, school of film.
Who recently passed away.
Yeah. Alas.
But yeah, I agree that Barbarella does have definitely more surreal weirdness going on and more kind of like creepiness.
Yeah.
Because not all of Barbarella is creepy, but some of it is super creepy and weird.
Yeah.
The Italian film I'm thinking of that this movie should have been more like as far as just throwing random creepiness and odd stuff is Flash Gordon, the 1980 Flash Gordon film.
Flash.
It should have been more like that. If I'm reading you correctly, David, it should have thrown even more stuff into the blender because that movie pulls stuff out of its hat every 10 seconds.
And yeah, and again, in fairness, this was a cheap made for TV series. So I should qualify my objections, like knowing that there's limits to what they could possibly do. Mm. But it would have been fun if there had been even more of that.
That's fair. I kind of felt like it wasn't actually trying to be that. I felt like it was just trying to be a straight up adventure.
Well, I got something on that. I'll save for my next like.
Okay, so third dislike. Sean.
Me. That's me. Oh, it's my turn. Yay. Okay, well, it's going to be related to what Julia was saying, which is that some of the dialogue in this is really painful. And... Julie's covered a lot of it, but I just want to cover one particular instance that just I threw my hands up and I was like, WTF, I don't want to do this anymore. That's not cool. Because I can accept like bad dialogue that's just like, okay, this is hilarious because it's terrible, you know. But then there's this point where, you know, Yor has saved, like he's fought another dinosaur because apparently, like, really it shouldn't be Yor the hunter from the future. It should be Yor the dinosaur killer. Because he spends half this damn movie killing dinosaurs. I mean, frickin' A, man. So he kills this other dinosaur, and, like, they take him to the people, and the guy's, like, this weird sort of, like, clearly he's been smoking a lot of pot guy is like, hey, you can have my daughter, dude. And he's like, yeah, no, and the daughter says to him, take me with you, stranger. And that was the moment at which I was just like, really? Like, that's what she says after he's fought a dinosaur and there's like this weird looking like Aryan guy like standing before like what is going on? What are you teaching your women in this world? Like that they're just like little things that if like anybody like is this how this works when you get like a husband? Like has that guy, the hippie pot smoking guy, has he killed like 9 dinosaurs and he's got like 9 wives? Is that whole village just his wives and children?
Yeah, pretty much. And it was super creepy because that village was very much coded as sort of like the Polynesian village.
Yeah.
Right. So like that was even super creepier that like this white dude shows up and they're like, you are our savior. Here, take our daughter.
Yeah, mighty whitey. Yeah. This gets into one of my major dislikes. Yeah.
And she seems like totally happy with it, which is also what weirded me out. I was like, why? He's creepy. He kills dinosaurs, dude.
But those dinosaurs were going to kill them.
I know, but that's – I'm sorry, but like, you know, like, don't get me wrong.
I think it's super creepy, but I don't think it's because he kills dinosaurs. I think it's super creepy for other reasons.
Yeah. Well, it is – I know, but I'm just – maybe I just don't understand like attraction, but that just – I'm sorry. Like if a woman was like, I'm going to save you from a giant dinosaur, I'd be like, that's cool, but I'm still not going to go on a date with you because that's not the reason why I go on dates with people. Like, dinosaur killing is not, like, one of my hot buttons.
Yeah, basically this goes back to my very first dislike, which is that women are prizes. Yeah.
They prizes. They even say it at one point explicitly.
This is how it works in our – yeah, that's right. You're right.
Right. If you save save somebody, you get, like, a free woman and it comes with, like, a Happy Meal. Right. I mean, that's basically what it is. It's disgusting, but at the same time, like – I don't know if that – first off, some historian who listens to this show needs to like a prehistoric historian. Like, did that ever exist or is this like some weird like modern invention? Like we just imagine prehistoric people like gave up women as prizes.
This is the far future, Sean.
Oh, I'm sorry, the far future. Fuck.
That's what we're moving towards.
I hope not.
Oh, God. I could hear Liz burning our podcast in effigy for this.
She doesn't listen to podcasts.
That's good. If you do, Liz, we apologize.
It is an old kind of trope. I mean, if you look at all sorts of things that are from, you know, medieval stuff where it's like the woman is the prize in the game. If Robin Hood manages to win this contest, then he wins the hand of Maid Marian.
Mm-hmm. Right. But like, I get it as a trope in literature, but did that like, it's just a dumb question because I don't know enough about early history, but like, did that exist in cultures like to a point where like, not like an isolated, like one little group in like an isolated place, but like that it was a big enough deal. Like if you, like women were given away as prizes at feats of strength. I don't know. And I don't know. Anyway, it's just,
I don't know, but they certainly were commodified.
Oh, absolutely.
They definitely are seen as property and given away. And like, that is the whole like tradition of marriage and dowries and so forth, is that your father is paying for somebody else to take you.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, okay. Anyway, that's why I went. The dialogue is terrible, and there are lots of kinds of other problems, but you know, the dialogue sometimes just annoyed me. It's like, why are you saying this line? Why did you not just stop them and say, yeah, I'm just not going to say that. I know I need a $50 paycheck, but I don't need it that bad.
Maybe they did. That cappuccino and that Italian pizza costs money.
Oh, man. Now I want pizza.
Wait, you got to pay for your gelato somehow.
Exactly.
Italian summers are hot.
That's true. That's true.
Gelato.
Mm-hmm.
Gelato.
Anyway, moving on. Let's go to our fourth like.
Julia.
So my fourth like?
Yep.
Is the woman scientist exists.
Oh,
so like the women in this movie kind of like get a bad rap all the way through, except there is one woman who's a scientist, and we get to see her being like taken seriously as a scientist, which is, you know, at least there is the one woman who is actually a scientist. She does things
that
aren't just like scream for help.
True.
Yep, she's my also my fourth like. Ina is her name, and she seems to be, except for that blind guy, seems to be the head of this resistance, no less. So she's not only a woman scientist who does things and is clearly competent. She's also a high leader of this resistance that's working against the Overlord and working for the Overlord at the same time. So she's living a double life. She's awesome. I mean, the rest of the women characters in this movie are badly done, but she's not, and she is completely not interested in Yor at all.
Right.
She's interested in her work and she's interested in her activism, but she's not particularly interested in his romance at all. Like, she's interested in him and what he could maybe do to help her cause.
Yeah.
But not in having a romance.
Exactly, and I appreciated that because the bad way other women are treated in this movie. So yes, Ida is my fourth like as well.
Sweet,
David.
Well, if my last like was the moments of, I think, deliberate delirium, like the mirror scene, I also really appreciated the moments where the film I don't think it was deliberate, or where the movie just goes nuts. And I think one of the standout moments for me there was when Yor places the bomb on the atomic pile. So, all right, and then he has to be rescued by Pag in that trapeze moment. So you've got these cavemen in a factory with laser rifles doing a trapeze act to place a bomb on an atomic pile while that Casio Carmina Burana thing is going on.
Okay, but David, I just want you to think about what you just said and try to tell me how that's not awesome.
No, that's the thing. This is my like. This is awesome.
Okay.
This is a like. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like that happens. Like, yes. You know, this is why I watch movies.
You know? Okay. I thought you were complaining about it. I was like, no, you can't really complain about this.
No. What human being could? So, yeah, stuff like that was absolutely marvelous.
Yes.
I did love that scene. I was like, how's he going to get back? Is he sacrificing himself? And then Pag shows up out of nowhere and is like, I got you, bro. And
see, this would have saved Gene Hackman in the Poseidon Adventure if they'd done that.
So the Poseidon Adventure is basically missing cavemen and trapezes?
That would have saved the day, yes.
That's awesome. That's awesome. A+. A+ for you today.
What about you, Sean?
All right, we're on fourth, right?
Yeah.
Fourth.
Well, I'm just going to get this out of the way because we have mentioned it. Pag. I love Pag. It's a little old Italian man who runs around like with a bow offering folksy wisdom, and he's just adorable, and he does trapeze acts as David was just describing, and he's just adorable, and I want one.
And he's reinvented missile weapons in this after Singularity Fall culture. He's the only one who has.
That's
and,
true.
So basically what you're saying is, Peg Slug, he's the man.
Yes.
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 And if it's a bow and his name is Peg,
he's actually got a slug on the end of it.
Peg Slug.
Peg Slug, your slug.
Peg. So I think David had a different joke.
Oh, I was just going to say that if he has a bow and his name is Peg, it must really be short for Paganini then, right?
Zing.
Oh, being cheap. And now we brought in music and opera. Wow, whose grand unified theory of yore?
This is great. Everything exists in one space. This film is the most unintentionally brilliant piece of cinema we've watched for this feature.
Now, if we're going to get Tommy Westfall into this, we'd win forever.
I just wonder how the person who made us watch this movie will feel about this podcast when he hears it.
I think,
oh, John.
I think you'll appreciate it.
That'd be John Stevens. John, is this what you wanted?
Tell I feel like yes you no. should give us some sort of Twitter epic to show your appreciation.
I feel like he would love this. I feel this would bring him so much joy because he really wanted us to watch this. And we're hilarious right now. Or at least it seems that way because I've been intoxicated.
Intoxication might be skewing our perceptions.
Yeah, I might get to the podcast and we're all just like, except for David. David would be really articulate, but the rest of us would be like, Peg. Yeah.
I'm stone cold sober and we're absolutely brilliant. There's no question about it.
Awesome. Awesome. My life is complete.
He's stone cold sober. We know he's been drinking Coke without sugar in it, and we've already established that that can make people drunk.
There you go.
You can't trust a word he says. Should we go to our fourth dislike?
I think so. I think, yeah. So we can try to get this done before midnight.
So, women competing with each other. This is a separate issue from Women as Prizes. Because like Women as Prizes is bad enough, but women as prizes who are also jealous of other women being prizes, it makes it an extra level of bad and like culminating in a cat fight that has no reason to exist aside from we want to see two women fighting. And they're not going to fight in a way that's, you know, a realistic fight way. They're going to fight in a way that's best showing off their bodies and then gives us a nice like segue into fridging one of them, who then inexplicably, when it's clear that she's dying, is suddenly like, oh, you should give my medallion to Kala because she loves you. But like up until that point, it's just pretty much no, we hate each other and you must die.
Yeah, I'm not sure this movie understands what love is, but I'm pretty sure somebody who's willing to commit homicide for you is probably, well, granted, there's no homicide in this world because it's revamped the law. So, yeah.
Like, because if I was dying and Kala had just tried to kill me, first of all, I wouldn't be letting her hold my hand. And second of all, I wouldn't be like, you should just totally stay with this woman. She loves you. I would be like, this bitch just tried to kill me. I'm just saying, like, you should know that she is totally homicidal. And if I hadn't been killed by these cavemen, I would have been killed by her.
Right. Or she would be dead.
Like, just to warn you.
She's crazy.
Because I'm not clear that, like, I'm not even clear that Roa was actually actively competing. Like, I think Roa was possibly content to be the first wife and to have Kala be like the second place wife because she was like, you don't understand, and Kala's like, I understand that one of us must die. And then later when when he's offered the 17-year-old, I kind of get the feeling that like Kala is looking at her like, I will murder you if you are the second wife. And I kind of got the feeling that like it might not even be that he's a serial monogamist. It might be that he is with her and feels obligated to be with her and knows that she's going to try to kill any other woman that he's with. So he's like,
so he's actually terrified for the last half of the film.
I don't want my first wife to kill you, so I'm just going to tell you to stay here.
Yeah, I mean, Peg tries to tell Claude, oh, you can be the second wife, and knowing, but and then Claude's just afraid, oh, they'll just go off and leave us, and I'll be left alone, and Pog just says, well, that would be his path then. And no, she's not having it. And we get this strange, useless and demeaning conflict on between the two of them. And I mentioned it before in one of my dislikes, and I don't like it at all.
Yeah. So this is actually related. It is basically my dislike is women who fight over men for apparently no reason, at least no real reason that's relevant. And the thing is for me that this film literally sets up that she has grown up, Kayla has grown up in a culture where polygamy is normal.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. Pag literally sits her down and is like, well, he didn't sit her down, but she's already sitting down. And he says, look, like, this is normal. Like, he's basically telling her, like, you've seen this already. You realize that he could have, like, 19 wives. I mean, granted, there are only, like, 18 of them and they all just died, but right, but he could have multiple wives, so she has to have seen this happen, so this cannot have been a shock to her, so it doesn't make sense why there is the jealousy, at least jealousy that is homicidal.
In fact we see that as we get a kind of warning sign with that from her right from the start when they're going on the quest to find his people, and she says, and there'll be other women, right? So she's preemptively jealous before she even meets anyone else.
Right, and it doesn't make a whole lot, and it gets of course worse. This film does this weird thing with monogamy and reinforcing it, because you know she tries to kill Roa, and then suddenly Roa gets banged over the head by the creepy cave dude guys who don't shower, and then she's dying, and then like what Julie was saying, like they're holding hands, and she's like, give her the thingy, my bob, and it'll be great, and like, what? Why are you friends? And then after that, suddenly he is super monogamous. But why? He was perfectly willing to shack up with two women.
Yeah,
without.
And I think honestly, it's just so that it can stop Kala from killing other people.
Because you've established that she's homicidal.
Yeah, pretty much. Because like she's looking at the little 16-year-old or whatever she is from the other tribe, like she's gonna kill her.
Yeah, I agree with Julia's reading of this. He begs off of her. She's a nice, sweet girl, but no, you're not gonna live 6 days if I take you with us. So
yeah, like, and he's very, very careful in his wording. He's like, you are a sweet child,
and you
not a sweet girl, not a sweet woman, a sweet child, which is like degendered.
Yeah.
So that Kala will not even be like, you were attracted to her. No, he thinks of her as a child, so therefore she's not an object of lust at all. And he's like, but I already have a woman.
But Kala is the daughter of a king. Maybe that explains her insane desire to be the one and only, because she's royalty.
I'm not even sure they know what kings are.
Well, I'm just working.
I feel like the king probably had several wives. Like, I think she's just kind of out there.
She's just
got a lot of jealousy and homicidal urges.
She is out there, all right.
Oh yeah. She's definitely out there. All right, well, we let's do it. Let's go back to the – let's go to dislikes. Fourth dislike.
My fourth dislike.
Yeah.
Okay, my fourth dislike, what the heck with that ending? It goes way bombastic. I'm talking about specifically the death of the Overlord. So he's running for the elevator, and then it doesn't look like he's getting in, and then Yor throws that barber pole and he walks around for the next, what feels like 15 minutes, so it's not that long, with this barber pole stuck in him. It's like, what the hell? It's horribly bad. I just get trying to reach the controls, and they had the blind guy Antonio with this info dumping over how you're going to fail, this is not going to work, and everyone else trying to escape. It's just the movie was trying too hard at that point, and the seams were really, really, really starting to show. It's like, it felt like the conflict between Yor and the Overlord just ended. It wasn't that satisfactory that way. It just sort of stumbling around towards its ending. It's like, okay, I'm entertained. It's weird, weird, weird. It's like, and it just kind of loses it in that last bit. There should be a better ending conflict between Yor and the Overlord, in my opinion. So that's my fourth dislike.
Excellent, David.
Well, I think Julia covered pretty much everything I had on the roles of the women in the film, so I'm just going to second everything she said.
Everything, huh? Alrighty then.
Okay, you, Sean.
Already did mine.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good. We're going back fifth lifetime.
Back to the lakes.
Fifth and final life.
We're almost there.
All right, this is my big one. Yeah, this is so exciting. This is the moment I've been waiting for the entire podcast.
Oh my god.
It is clear that this takes place in the same universe as Sons of Steel. It is clear that this is the future of Sons of Steel, and it doesn't take place in Sydney. It's not in Australia. But these people are the people of the future that, like, are the same kinds of people that we see in Jod and whatever the other guy's name was. Except for some reason, they speak a language that we hear them speaking is their own language. They're fluent in it, so they're not speaking broken English, because Jod has learned some English, but clearly is fluent in her own language, whatever that is. But that's why her English was broken. But like, yes, they are clearly wandering around being barbarians in the world of Sons of Steel. And Yor and Roa are clearly like Sons of Brass, possibly bronze, gold. I'm not sure. Not steel. And I'm not sure what they ride, because it's not the Shine, but they have medallions.
Oh, man. Oh,
and they are the Sons. Like, so the alternate title for this movie could be Sons of Brass. I'm just saying.
I feel sorry for David, because I don't think he knows the movie.
David,
if
you have not seen Sons of Steel, you have to see it, because you will love it.
We'll make sure you get to see it. We will make sure.
It's amazing. And I feel like you will particularly enjoy it. If anyone else will enjoy it in this podcast, it's David.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will make sure that he will
that
be able
he gets
to see it.
To see that movie, because it's amazing. And then you can listen to our Sons of Steel podcast and be like, oh, I see.
I got to figure out how. But anyway, we'll figure that out.
But yeah. We'll figure that out later. But the point is, this clearly takes place in the same universe as Sons of Steel. There has been a nuclear holocaust. There are some survivors. They are basically like living in some sort of primitive way, but still have strangely accurate hairstyling. I mean, look at Roa's hair. That hair, like Jod's exquisite perm. You can't get that without like artificial curling and spraying.
And there was the mascara too, right?
So. Yeah, like, and they were wearing makeup. Yes, they were. They had very, very exquisitely cut furs that would only cover part of them in the most appealing way. And for designer, I mean, it was Italian.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, this is basically apparently the European landmass of Sons of Steel universe, and that's apparently the Brass Lands.
The Brass Lands.
I'm not sure.
The Brass Lands, and I guess it's like Sons of Brass ride the bat hang glider.
Yeah, I like this theory as much as my post-singularity one, Julia.
This means this that in this, and you'll notice, like, even the Overlord, like, he talks about destroying things and other things and controlling things, and he says something about, like, level by level, and it's as if he is even somehow psychically connected to Sekta, who's in sub-level 7 over in Australia.
Oh, he's a spiritual brother to Sekta. Oh god, that's
Danger
brilliant.
Danny Oz is going to be so happy about this right now.
So yeah, that's that was my favorite thing about this, was that I realized it was basically a spinoff of Sons of Steel.
That's adorable. All right.
It's going to be difficult for me to top that. I don't think I'm even going to try. So I've mentioned it. I'm going to throw them all together for my fifth life. There's some very strange elements that just fill this movie, that just filled me with glee, all the weird stuff. I mean, we see the desert tribesmen with the flaming weapons and these two pointed sticks and a flaming sword. We get the ice that doesn't melt. We get all these weird post-apocalyptic dinosaurs and the bat creature. We get robots. I mean, this movie just takes a genre blender from movies from the last 15 years and Italian cinema apparently, and decides to just throw it all in. And it's when they work, they work gloriously. It's just a stew of stuff. It's like, I kept watching. It's like, okay, what are they going to throw into next? Like, oh, it's a Dimetrodon. Great. They've called it an orbital strike on the Polynesian village now. Like, wow. It's just like, this movie just keeps throwing all this stuff. Oh, it's a communicator. It's like again and again and again, just like dumping stuff in. It's just like, okay, it was never boring to see we have a hall of mirrors now. We have a weird set out of Star Wars. It's just like, it filled me with glee. Just keep seeing all the stuff that they just kept to throw in. I mean, the movie could be tedious at times, but when they started throwing stuff in, I started paying attention to see just what they're going to throw in next. That's my fifth and final like.
Well said.
Well said. All right, David.
Seeing the name Anthony Dawson in the director credit at the beginning of the film, since that is that's the frequent pseudonym of Antonio Margheriti, and that gives the film a kind of pedigree. Margheriti directed among the very first Italian space movies, Simon Outer Space and Battle of the Worlds, and he was also, though he never was in the front rank of the gothic horror filmmakers like Mario Bava and Riccardo Freda, he did some very striking films in the 60s, Castle of Blood and The Virgin of Nuremberg. So I mean, there is a I mean, this ties the film into some, you know, like a kind of honorable tradition in Italian film. And there's a write-up of in Phil Hardy's book talking about his Battle of the Worlds, which describes it as an object lesson in how to let cinema triumph over both script and acting, allowing visual style and imagination to carry their own corrosively fascinating meanings. And though that imaginative force that is present in some of his earlier films, I mean, this is a weaker one of his movies, but there are moments that start to approach that, or at least we get the echoes of what those other films could do. So it was neat seeing that he directed this and watching the film with his work in the background, even if it was, you know, late period, late career, low budget work.
Yeah. It's glorious. I had actually never not heard. I didn't realize there was his pseudonym. So this is good. I've heard of him under his real name. I didn't connect him with this movie.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, it's his glory days were definitely the '60s. But there's you see traces of like there are moments where I guess when the sort of the visual imagination seemed to be there's like okay yeah I can see this is. You know, there's moments here where Margheriti's firing on all cylinders.
Yeah. Yes, he is.
Aww. That's adorable. I'm just going to say that to all of our last ones because it's just funny. By the way, this was nominated for 3 Razzie Awards, just so you all know.
Yeah, one of them was for the song.
I know, aww. Worst original song for... Which, by the way, is just bullshit. I'm sorry. Worst World is classic 80s genius.
Yeah, it's like, that's a really weak nomination.
Yorthog, he's the man.
And that is apparently also, I see the what the title in Italian would have been, Yours World.
Really?
And that, in fact, you're the hunter from the future?
Yes.
Well, because it says Il Mondo di Yor.
Yeah, which is Yours World.
Or Il Mondo. I don't know how to say it in Italian, so I guess in In Spanish, it would be El Mundo de Yor. Because Mundo is world.
So, like, I thought I saw that it was based on Argentinian comics and that it had he had a different name and also was actually the hunter because it was El Cazador, which would be hunter.
Yeah, so I think the title's probably, you know, gone through a few. I mean, maybe the title we're getting in English is closer to the original comic book's title.
There's a comic book for Yor?
It was a comic book first, then it became the TV series, which got then re-edited into the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm getting my information from Wikipedia, so take that with a grain of salt, but it said it was Argentinian comics.
I am so excited right now because I want to read Yor. If I can find it, which is probably
If you look at the Wikipedia page, it'll tell you about what it was, so you know what you're looking for. Of course, those comics are going to be in Spanish, so you have to read them in Spanish, but...
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm going to ask a really dumb question. Isn't Dago an offensive term?
Yes.
Yeah. I got in trouble when I was young and foolish because my... Now we're really going off on topics because this was when I was living on Staten Island. My father gave me some ice and said, go to the store and get some guinea bread or Dago bread. And I went to the A&S pork store and asked for it. And the proprietor of this Italian pork bread store was very unhappy with me. I was very embarrassed and didn't go back in that store for years.
Oh, I'm on Comic Vine, and when I searched for Yor under the character wiki, I got obviously Yor, and then I got one that's from Eurocomics where it's called Dago.
Oh.
Presumably written by Italians, so I'm guessing that's probably used ironically.
Well, but you're using a word like that in Italian wouldn't necessarily you're referring to something a derogatory term used in English, right?
Oh, okay. So it may have different meanings. All right. I'm sorry. I just saw that and I was like, that looks odd. But anyway, totally a far field. So I guess I should do my last slide.
Yes.
Okay. So I've done the theme song. Oh, it is the fact that, much like Zardoz, although Zardoz I think was intentionally trying, this film is kind of in moments unintentionally brilliant, particularly in some of the things that we've talked about before, which is its sort of handling of the, I guess, what you might call a Hitlerian myth, which is, you know, there's this like Aryan overlord guy who wants to turn everything into androids that can just reproduce themselves, and instead, his own people decide to sacrifice themselves and destroy him and his androids in order to protect the purity of everything else. And then, of course, Yor is going to go around basically intermixing with everybody, presumably. I mean, I don't know what he's going to do. Maybe he's going to take 15 wives, or he's going to stay monogamous. I don't really know what his deal is. It's obviously not handled perfectly well, and I think you could probably find lots of flaws. But I love that was part of this narrative. That it was, even if it was just really painfully obvious, at least it was sort of handled and then like soundly rejected as just bad. Despite the fact that I think one of the very first things that sort of annoyed me was that here comes this blonde blue-eyed guy and everyone's like, why is he so different? And it's like, maybe because everybody else is black-haired and brown-eyed and this guy doesn't look like you. And it seemed like that would be the obvious question, because there's nothing else that's really actually different about Yor, except that apparently he's good at fighting dinosaurs. So, yeah, I like
that.
And
he's the only person who can speak like a normal person.
That's true, too. To them, he must speak weird.
He comes from over the mountains, he wears a medallion that no one else has, and he can actually talk in complete sentences like a normal person.
Yeah, this is going to get to my last dislike in a big way.
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to have similar last dislikes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to have to pause everybody really quick. My cat is currently losing his mind over something he has found, and I'm worried it is a wild animal.
Okay. Right.
So if you give me just a second just to check what it is. It's probably just a bug, but yeah. I'll be right back.
He does live in Florida.
What is this all about, sir?
This is the point in the podcast where Sean gets eaten by his pet monitor lizards.
That's not funny. He lives in Florida. I don't know if there are any monitor lizards in Florida. There are certainly large snakes.
We know that Sean doesn't actually keep pet monitor lizards, so it's okay.
Well, that damn thing has got to die.
Something
they heard cockroach, I think he said.
Something is going to lose his life. Hopefully he's not doing a Renfeld on it or something.
Oh, God.
I was thinking when you were talking about bugs, we were talking about vampires and stuff. I remember my mind just went right to there. You know, killing the smaller life stuff.
The blood is the life, Mr. Renfield.
Well, and as Yor tells us, the blood of your enemy will make you stronger.
Oh my God! I noticed though he didn't do that with the diamond shard, and he didn't go drinking any blood.
Yeah, no, it was just in the first scene to establish.
There was another one showing up.
Also, that's why he's different, because he drinks the blood of his enemies.
He's also the only Scandinavian in a Mediterranean context.
Ron is also Scandinavian.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but they're the only
ones, yeah.
The only ones. Plus the people trapped in the Ice Eight. And well, what about them? Are they ever going to get freed?
I think they're dead, is what we're told.
Yeah, so, and since we learned about his past, like, I kind of have to wonder if Roa hadn't died, would we find out that they were actually siblings?
Well,
are they basically Luke and Leia?
That would add real incest to this movie.
Well, Luke and Leia kissed, too.
Yeah, but Luke and Leia did not have conjugal relations. And it's very clear that...
Oh, yeah, that's right, because, yeah, we do. We then cut to an afterwards.
I guess we do. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, they totally had sex.
And yet we're never told that there was a second ship that left the
No, we're pretty much island. Just told that the one ship leaves with his dad on it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And by this point, this is 83, so that's post-Empire Strikes Back. Right?
Yep.
So,
yeah.
No, it's entirely possible.
Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry about that, guys. It was a very big roach.
So I think we're up to final dislikes, right?
Yeah.
The final dislikes. Okay, sorry.
We give you value here on the Skippy and Fancy.
I really want to get Peter Arulian to like record that song, but with change the words. But anyway,
just final to the final dislike. Like that's all.
That's it. I want him to sing everything else for the song normal, but just its final dislike. Yeah. This probably isn't a great plan.
my final dislike is all of the Aryan race stuff. I was super not into that. And, like, it was really, really uncomfortable all the way through. Because, like, basically, Yor comes, and as David was saying while you were gone, he's the only Scandinavian in a Mediterranean context. He's blonde-haired, you know, muscle-bound guy. And everybody's like, he's so different. He's amazing. He can kill dinosaurs and win all our women, and we love him. And, then, like, the second he meets Roa, he's like, oh, I don't need the brunette lover because now I have found another Aryan like me. We can start a new race. And there's this whole thing where, like, Kala is complaining to Pag, and Pag's like, you know, you could be the second wife. And she's like, no, they're going to leave us and start a new race. And he's like, well, if that happens, you can't stop them from their destiny. And I'm like, no, I disagree with all of that. And then he gets the island, which is populated with other, like, Aryan type people, and the overlord is like, you have perfect DNA, so I want to create a new race in your image. And I'm just like, yeah, I don't love any of this at all. And especially with all of the stuff, like when he goes to the one tribe that is basically coded as the sort of Polynesian tribe where they are all wearing flower necklaces and shells and grass skirts, and he's saved them from a dinosaur, and they're like, take our daughter, we love you. And she's like, I would like to go with you, blonde-haired stranger. And he's like, thank you, I'm very benevolent, but I don't need your children because I have another woman who isn't you, and that's okay. And then, like, basically also brings destruction everywhere he goes to. Yeah, there were lots of things about the race stuff in here that I didn't like.
Oh, yeah, and we haven't even And as a listeners can guess, yes, my final dislike is right in accord with Julie's. Consider the cape. You could read the caveman as sort of an undermentioned sort of thing. Attacking higher forms. There's clear racial class lines throughout this entire movie, and you could even read the Overlord as oppressing the one true higher Aryan race, because the Aryan race is working against him and he's clearly oppressing them. So yeah, he's not blonde. Exactly.
Yeah. And in the end, like Yor and some of the Aryan rebels get to escape and reform the world in their image.
Yeah. So yeah, the racial optics, this movie is horrible. If you think about it, it makes you feel uncomfortable. Like, what are you guys thinking?
That's why I made the skit I did, because, duh. Like, yeah. He's going to have babies, and, you know, he may find out this is a big mistake one day.
So, basically, I agree with Julia. The racial text in this movie is uncomfortable at best.
Okay.
And horrible at worst. David.
Well, third to that, because the only way of making it work is what I said earlier, to see it as a kind of wildly parodic parable of about just that. Unfortunately, that is an unsupportable reading. So, what you two just said.
But I just find that utterly fascinating.
Did they do it intentionally? Is it unintentional? Standards of what we think of as racial class consciousness. Why did they do it this way? Why go through all this?
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of, like, you know, sort of unpacking that. I mean, I obviously have only seen the film once, but it was just very, I thought it was very interesting. But obviously, I can imagine from an emotional level, it would be very disconcerting.
Well, you do get a lot of some weird stuff happening along these lines in a lot of sort of Italian exploitation cinema.
I was going to ask you if you knew anything about that, David, whether this is some sort of weird Italian standards of beauty that I'm not aware of.
Some of that I don't know if I could speak precisely to that, but these kind of race lines. In sometimes the film's very confused and trying to have their cake and eat it too, right? So, I mean, to take the extreme, a movie like Cannibal Holocaust, which purports to criticize the European attitudes, but winds up reveling in the very thing it pretends to condemn. Right? So I can see some continuity between the fact that you had an entire subgenre of the Italian cannibal movie riven with the same problems, and I can see some connections along the lines of what you and Julia were just saying, being apparent in these films as well. And I agree with Sean; it's fascinating stuff, but it's also, I would like to view it as a parody of that, only I don't believe that it is.
It's probably certainly not. I don't think it's intentional.
No.
I think they set out to do something, and I mean, I don't think that whatever they intended to do is probably not what we're reading into it. But obviously, with literary interpretation, intention is not important.
Yep, it's the union of text, or in this case, cinema, and the viewer, and how what they put on the screen intersects with what the viewer sees and thinks and brings to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So, well, good. So, is that everybody?
Did you give your last dislike?
I haven't given mine. No, it's you guys already did your three.
Yep.
Aww.
So you get.
What
to-
are you awing about? We've been doing this for like 3 hours.
It hasn't probably been three. It's been a while though. Okay. Well then, I'm gonna totally have a softball one, if that's okay.
Go for it.
Okay. I am sick and tired of the heroes being like full on clean chested muscular dudes. Like honestly, the hero of this movie should be Pag, who is hairy, who's slightly overweight, but also is really good with the bow and actually is quite nimble, as we've learned from watching this film. Yeah, more so than perhaps we originally thought. And this is part of the reason why I like Man of Steel is, like honestly, like, he's hairy. Superman is, like, hairy. He's got, like, man hair. Like, you could, like, freaking grip that stuff and, like, hang on to it while he flew because he's Superman, so his hairs are really strong, right? But in this, it's just, like, I don't know why. I just get really bored of, like, every hero just, like, he's got a perfect body and he's got clean cut. Like, he just looks like you could, like put some oil on him and, like, he'd go down the slip and slide on his chest, like, no problem, right? And I don't like that. I just find that really, like, just boring. And it's, like, it's not happening for me. You, like, grow a beard or something, right? How does he shave? How does he shave in this world?
How does anyone shave in this world?
Well, okay, actually, I could probably answer that. So, because I've read historical fiction and stuff where they've researched things and talked about people shaving by using, like, the sharpened edges of shells, and there were clearly shells in that world because the one tribe was wearing lots of shell necklaces.
Yes, the Polynesians.
But they had oil, so, you know, he could be all oiled up and he could have shaved all his hair off. But you are also having to remember that this is coming right on the heels of Conan the Barbarian, which came out in 1982 and also had, like, super muscle-bound, bare-chested man as the main hero, which was popular and successful. And this is clearly copying, like, all of that. This is in the height of He-Man and Arnold Schwarzenegger and bodybuilding and, like, having big muscles as, like, the male standard of beauty, which is not our current male standard of beauty, but in 1982 to 83, when this movie came out, it was.
And not to mention the umpteen Italian sword and sandal or peplum films of Hercules and Atlas and Machiste and on and on and on and on and on. There were dozens of these films with some of them with beards, I grant you, but otherwise, you know, the sort of the oiled bodybuilder mythic hero type. In fact, Yor is surprisingly svelte in comparison.
See, I believe that that Arnold Schwarzenegger probably can't grow chest hair anymore, just based on all the steroids he used. I feel like that would be a natural side effect. But this guy doesn't look like a steroid user.
Not every man has lots of chest hair. Some men don't.
Well, I'm going to solve that when I take over the world.
Some of us don't want chest hair, Sean.
Tough patooties. Everyone's getting chest hair when I am emperor. You're all taking a pill, and we're going to be chest hairy, and we're going to, like, run around with our chest hair. It's going to be great.
Okay, that's...
Well, then.
This got awkward.
I like how Sean doesn't, like, buy the overlord and doesn't sympathize with him at all, but then he, like, is like, when I take over the world, I'm going to make everyone grow chest hair by giving them pills. Like, yeah, but somehow this is an acceptable thing to do.
That's far less evil than what he was going to do. This seems like a reasonable compromise for universal
healthcare.
Sean, that's
where it starts. It starts with you saying, I'm going to give people a pill to have chest hair, and then you, like, start thinking about all the other modifications and how that tribe doesn't actually seem like the tribe you wanted to make, so you're just going to bomb them and make a new tribe out of someone else's perfect semen.
As we have already discussed, I would be perfectly fine if I had my island with androids who could do whatever
I
needed
them
to do.
You know, the Overlord probably thought that too when he started out.
I don't think so. I
and
think
he
has
found
repressed
out was that
childhood
none
feelings.
Of it was satisfying. It's never enough.
I don't
peace
think,
in our time.
I think he spent a lifetime being psychoanalyzed by Freud. That's probably what happened to him.
Psychoanalyzed by Freud?
So, yeah. Like, Freud somehow has, like, been transported to the future?
Yes.
Well, he could have been reconstructed as a computer AI.
Exactly what Paul just said is exactly what happened.
He also has metal hands, so there's been some kind of dismemberment there, which is a clear castration metaphor.
Bam. See? Boom. I am not like that because I still have my hands.
Yeah, that's not necessarily a guaranteed permanent.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Anyways, I'm just so tired of, like, clean-chested, muscular dudes.
You want a wider variety of protagonists.
I would just have loved Pag to have been the hero. Like, just the idea of this, like, hairy, kind of short, overweight, older man, like, and but like, he's the hero. Like, that
well,
would have been so much
greater. If it makes you feel any better, I like to think that Peg is a long way into the future descendant of Sykes from Inspector Gadget.
Yay! I love Sykes so much. Do you think Peg wants to open up like a prehistoric version of like a hardware store?
I think that Sykes probably got most of his knowledge from working in the hardware store that he ran for the tribe.
That is post-historic anyway.
Post-historic.
So are you saying it's like genetic memory?
Hardware yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah.
Awesome.
He looks like the kind of guy who would want to sell vinyl siding to someone.
Oh, yeah.
Or what would be the prehistoric equivalent, which I guess would just be really,
it's
really fancy.
It's post-historic. It's not prehistoric. Vinyl siding could still exist.
Yeah.
It's because they could totally make that. They can manufacture that.
They could scrape little bits of the non-melting ice and turn it into vinyl siding. The ice
ship, and the ship they got away with, no doubt, has a replicator.
No doubt.
Okay, great. All right. Let's get down to our grades, guys, because we've got to grade this movie. And somehow I feel like we're not going to be very mean to this, because I feel like we enjoyed our lives while watching this. So, Julia, what grade would you give this movie?
I'm going to give this movie a C. It's by far not the worst movie we've seen, but I'm not going to watch it again, probably.
I think
unlike Sons of Steel, which I will totally watch again and again and again.
I can't wait to give that one to my professor. I told him about it and I was like, this is a movie you need to see. Excellent. What about you, Paul?
I'm going to agree with Julia. I mean, I'm not going to rush out to watch this ever again, but we've seen much worse movies on torture cinema than this. So I'm just going to give it a C and let it pass on that.
Excellent. David?
I find it so difficult because, as in terms of, if I just try to think of it rationally, I should probably give it something like a C too. But if I think about the sheer joy that this movie gave me, I'm going to have to give it a B plus.
Seriously?
It's a bad, bad film. Oh. But, you know, I mean, by the same standards, I'd give Glenn or Glenda an A.
Oh. No, we've had high ratings on torture cinema movies before, David. So
okay,
I mean, I gave Sons of Steel an A+.
All right, well there you go. Yeah, so I'm gonna go with the B+. You know, the song alone.
The song is and that is a big part of my C grade.
Yeah.
the song I will listen to again.
He's the man. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, that is a classic. Well, okay, well, my grade, unfortunately, I'm going to give it a C as well. It's not the worst thing we've watched, and I did enjoy watching it, but I always grade on the quality of the film, mostly, except for if I enjoyed a film so much that my life was improved by watching it, as was the case with Sons of Steel, but that was mostly because Jen hated it so much that I could finally get her back for loving Waterworld. So... yeah, and that's been a running gag.
I don't know what's
gag.
Wrong with Jen that she did not like Sons of Steel. That was a great movie.
Yeah, that movie's just audacious enough, and I think David's going to love it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that. And I can definitely say, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my life has been improved by watching You're the Hunter from the Future.
That explains the B+. That's justification enough.
I feel like that's going to show up on the next Your DVD cover. I can honestly say, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my life has been improved by watching You're the Hunter from the Future, David Annandale.
There we go.
Movie yeah. Film critic.
And I will stand by those words.
Excellent. All right, guys. Well, anyway, so thanks for folks who voted to pick this one. We'll have a new poll up probably before this goes up or maybe shortly after. It'll be soon because we have to pick one for the end of the next month, July. So, when this go up, it'll be July most likely. So on that note, thanks, Julia, for watching this movie and drinking alcohol and enjoying our lives together.
Your slug, he's the man.
And thank you, Paul.
So where did those medallions come from in the first place? And what was on Rhoda's medallion? That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Recipe for really good pizza.
That, and it's now lost to time because Kala can't read the medallion.
It was in the director's commentary, didn't you listen?
I didn't realize there was director's commentary.
There isn't. I made that up. That was a total lie.
Okay.
But wouldn't that be great if there was?
Oh, God.
We should be
It said literally, Sons of Brass ride the giant bat as a hang glider. That's what it said.
And thank you, David, for your first torture cinema, in fact. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. And let me leave you with the question, who the hell are those people on the poster for the movie?
You mean the alien UFO people?
No, the people who are the person who's supposed to be Yor and the person who's supposed to be Kala.
Oh, I didn't get a good look.
Oh, yeah, you're talking along with the alien lights and they're like standing on this
on the pillar
lens.
Thing.
Yeah, it's like
As far as I can tell, it might be Will Ferrell or someone.
A very very young Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
That's that.
I mean, no, it's an artistic representation. It's basically like the cover of many science fiction and fantasy novels from my youth.
I want to read that because that all that does is it makes me think that he's fighting aliens, and so like, he's running around like hunting down those little gray bastards from X-Files, and he's just like cutting them down with an axe.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this does indicate that there are multiple flying saucers in the movie, so it is a total lie.
Right, because there's not a single flying saucer.
Mm-mm.
No, there's just only a Viper from Battlestar Galactica.
Oh my God! Yeah, and this poster is just so wrong. He is from a future world, trapped in prehistoric time, searching for his past. A hunter of incredible power and strength. In his quest for his origin, he and the woman he loves must fight hostile tribes, battle deadly beasts, and try to survive the violent forces of a newly born Earth. They really needed an editor for that. Oh my
God. It's an incredibly detailed misreading of the film.
Right, and almost none of that actually occurs. I'm not even convinced he loves Kala.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we've already established that he just wants to stop her from killing.
Right. At least there's no, like, really gratuitous sex scenes in this.
Made for TV.
That's true. That's true. Well, okay. On that note, guys, we got to close out. So if you want to suggest a movie, you can easily do that. You can send us email. All those details will be at the end, you know, website, all that good stuff. So there's a little bit that'll be added on at the end. You can suggest films, or we have a lot of films to go. But if you want to suggest one, go ahead. If you have a comment, do feel free to leave one on the page, particularly if you've seen Yor and would like to leave your thoughts.
John Stevens, you owe us like an epic Twitter storify.
Yes, he does. Or a comment, or maybe a single blog post on your Hunters for the Future. I'm counting on
possibly
you,
a cover of the theme song.
Yes, I think the last one that Julia just said needs to happen on
you
YouTube,
go.
And you need to be in character as Yor.
There you go, John. Counting on you.
There we go. All right, guys. And on that note, awkward ending. And scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.